Alright, for sake, Heathcliff.
If only it weren't accompanied by quite so much background noise. The new series of Rewinder, starting on Saturday morning at 10:30. To listen on your smart speaker, just say play Radio 4.
And this is BBC Radio 4.
Good morning, it's 6 o'clock on Tuesday, the 27th of January. This is Today with Nick Robinson and Anna Foster.
Good morning, the headlines today. The commander of Donald Trump's controversial immigration crackdown is set to leave Minnesota after claiming the nurse who was shot dead on Saturday wanted to massacre his officers. We'll hear from our correspondents in the city.
They'll come up and ask us, hey, where are you from? You know, we have out-of-state license plates on a rental car. Are you an ICE agent? And that just gives you a sense of the suspicion right now.
About 50 Labour MPs have written to the party leadership urging them to rethink the decision to block Andy Burman from standing as an MP.
Also in today's programme, a friend or a threat? How should Keir Starmer approach China as he prepares to become the first British Prime Minister to visit the country in 8 years? And Hulse's famous planet suite has been reimagined.
Earth awakens. Water braids, shimmers. Rivers.
The nature writer Robert McFarlane tells us why a brand new movement has been composed to finally represent planet Earth. Before all of that, the BBC News is read for us this morning by Caroline Nichols.
The Democratic mayor of Minneapolis says some federal agents are beginning to leave the city after he held a call with President Trump. There's been a growing backlash to the killing of Alex Pretty on Saturday, weeks after Renee Good, another US citizen, was shot dead by immigration officers. Those leaving are expected to include the Border Patrol Chief, Gregory Bovino. But the Trump administration says he's not being relieved of his duties. A new envoy is being sent. Our correspondent, Tom Bateman, reports from Minneapolis.
Agents in gas masks fired irritants towards protesters who'd gathered for what they called a goodbye Bovino noise demo, banging drums and clattering pieces of wood outside the hotel where they said the Border Patrol commander was staying. His expected departure from Minneapolis, along with some of his agents, marks a partial victory for the demonstrators and for Minnesota's Democratic leadership. The White House appears to be trying to deflect the anger over the killing of Alex Pretty by moving Mr. Bovino, who had alleged the 37-year-old nurse intended to carry out a massacre before he was shot dead, despite there being no evidence for that claim. In a shift of tone, Mr. Trump said he had good phone calls with the Democrat leadership of the city and state. The mayor of Minneapolis, Jacob Frey's statement on the call said Mr. Trump had agreed that the present situation could not continue.
Around 50 Labour MPs have written to the Prime Minister and the chair of the party's National Executive Committee, calling on them to rethink the decision to block Andy Burnham from standing to be an MP. Sir Keir Starmer has defended the decision, claiming that allowing the Mayor of Greater Manchester to contest the Gorton and Denton by-election would have diverted resources away from other crucial elections. Here's our political correspondent, Jack Fenwick.
The MPs who signed the letter said the decision to block Andy Burnham caused a huge amount of anxiety and anger among colleagues. Labour won the seat in 2024 with a 13,000 majority, but Reform and the Greens are both expected to be much more competitive this time round. It had widely been expected that if Andy Burnham won the seat, it could open the door to him challenging Sir Keir for the Labour leadership later this year. The former Labour cabinet minister, Baroness Harman, told BBC Newsnight that her parliamentary colleagues should move on and focus on winning the by-election instead of discussing the decision to block Mr. Burnham.
Sir Keir Starmer will travel to China today, the first visit there by a British Prime Minister in 8 years. The trip comes a week after the government granted Beijing permission to build the biggest embassy in Europe in London. A number 10 source says ministers are determined to pursue a hard-headed, grown-up approach to the UK's relationship with China. Northern Ireland is to become the first area of the UK to bring in graduated driver licensing. New drivers who pass their test there will have restrictions on nighttime driving and the carrying of passengers. It's hoped the measure will help reduce the number of new young drivers involved in serious road accidents. Pat Delaney is from the Driver and Vehicle Agency.
The Road Traffic Order of Northern Ireland has provisions for penalties if those restrictions are not adhered to. So there's 3 penalty points or a fine of up to £1,000. But what we would hope particularly for new young drivers, is that parents and guardians will be very supportive of graduated driver licensing and will help to police that.
BBC News understands the government will today announce a cap on ground rents paid by leaseholders in England and Wales. Labour's election manifesto promised to tackle unregulated charges affecting some 5 million homes, mainly flats. But there had been concerns the government could retreat from the pledge, as Tara Welsh reports.
A ground rent is ultimately the fee paid by millions of homeowners for the ground beneath their buildings. The English Housing Survey estimates leaseholders pay a median annual ground rent of £120 a year, but many have complained about not being able to sell their home because the costs keep going up. Building owners have argued that a cap would damage investor confidence in the UK housing market. And recent reports have suggested the Treasury and the Housing Department have been at loggerheads over the issue, with concerns over how a cap would impact pension funds, which own some freeholds.
A new report has said that the UK's poorest families are getting poorer and that record numbers of people are classed as in very deep poverty. The Joseph Rowntree Foundation said more action on jobs and benefits was needed. A government spokesperson said they were taking decisive action to address poverty. A large UK study has found that the menopause can cause a loss of grey matter in women's brains, affecting memory and emotions, similar to that seen in Alzheimer's. It's been published in the journal Psychological Medicine. The changes it found might partly explain why some women are generally at greater risk of dementia than men. Here's our health reporter Michelle Roberts.
The study involved nearly 125,000 UK women, of whom 11,000 had MRI brain scans, and the results suggest the menopause takes a toll on the brain, even with hormone replacement therapy treatment. The regions affected are similar to those impacted in Alzheimer's disease. The researchers from Cambridge University say the findings might help shed light on why dementia is twice as common in women than in men. But more studies are needed to better understand how menopause impacts the brain and what, if anything, could be done about it.
The Jamaican drummer and music producer Sly Dunbar, one of the most revered figures in reggae, has died at the age of 73. He played on classic songs, including Bob Marley's Punky Reggae Party, and as half of the production team, Sly and Robbie worked with artists ranging from Bob Dylan to Grace Jones.
Caroline, thank you. It's now 7 minutes past six. Helen Willetts is at the BBC Weather Centre for us this morning. Morning, Helen.
Good morning, Nick. As I look at the radar picture in front of me, the UK is awash. This is Storm Chandra. It's a multi-hazard storm with not just rain, but damaging winds, hill snow. So one to watch, most certainly. Let's start the detail across England and Wales. There's still the amber warning in force across parts of southwest England for the rainfall amounts, where we have realised those amounts in the last 18 hours. Over 80 millimetres of rain has fallen over Dartmoor, and quite significant amounts, 20 to 30 in many areas. So the flood warnings are rising, and they will continue to do so. So it's wet and it's windy this morning. Gales around the coast, even severe gale force winds in places, obviously following recent storms that could impact here too, where perhaps trees have already been dislodged. So that wet and windy weather through the morning, slowly clearing from the southwest to brighter skies, but with heavy showers and thunderstorms and still squally winds. And further north, accompanying the rain, warnings out for snow over the hills. So that's something to watch for this morning for the Trans-Pennine routes. Temperatures fairly academic, 7 to 10 degrees. Northern Ireland also very wet here, and an amber wind warning for the eastern side of Northern Ireland, gusts of 75 miles an hour. Again, we're realising those sort of wind speeds now, which are likely to cause some damage and disruption. So really wet and windy, then squally showers this afternoon. For Scotland, the rain and the hill snow getting into the southern uplands and central belt now will push northwards across the rest of Scotland today, finally reaching the Northern Isles this evening. Temperatures around 4 to 7 degrees Celsius, but very windy here too.
Thank you, Helen. It's just coming round to 9 minutes past six now. Time for our first look at the morning papers. And Suella Braverman's defection from the Conservatives to Reform UK features widely this morning. The Daily Mirror says Nigel Farage has welcomed another Tory has-been into his ranks. The Guardian says the Conservatives are facing a backlash for initially suggesting that she defected following mental health issues. The Sun calls the Tory statement an extraordinary slur. The I quotes the ex-Deputy Speaker, Nigel Evans, who called the comments an absolute disgrace.
China hacked phones in number 10 is the headline on the front page of the Daily Telegraph. The paper says a years-long spying operation targeted senior figures, including aides to Boris Johnson and Rishi Sunak. The government declined to comment on the story. The Chinese embassy said China was a staunch defender of cybersecurity and that it had been resolute in combating all kinds of malign cyber activities.
The Daily Mail leads on the letter from Labour MPs to Sir Keir Starmer criticising the decision to block Andy Burnham from running in an upcoming by-election. The paper says MPs have warned that the Prime Minister's strike against the Greater Manchester Mayor has hastened his demise. The Times says senior Labour figures have privately conceded that they expect to lose the election in Gorton and Denton. Other sources say they are not writing the seat off.
A few papers report on a possible announcement by the Treasury of a package of support for pubs in England. The Financial Times says it'll be worth £100 million a year. The Treasury tells the paper that Sir Keir and the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, have been clear they're determined to support pubs, but the Telegraph says the tax relief is expected to be temporary.
And the Daily Express marks Holocaust Memorial Day by devoting its front page to an 80-year-old woman who was born in a concentration camp. The paper pictures Eva Clark looking directly into the camera and says, despite having 15 of her family murdered by the Nazis, she is still hopeful for a better future if we tackle rising anti-Semitism.
And we will be focusing on Holocaust Memorial Day after 8:30 this morning with two relatives of those who survived the Holocaust. It is now coming up to 11 minutes past six. The commander of Donald Trump's controversial immigration raids in Minneapolis is leaving the city as criticism mounts of the shooting dead of not one but two protesters. The BBC's Carl Nasman is in the city, has been on the streets and told me more about the Border Patrol chief, Gregory Bovino.
He's been, I think, fair to say, kind of the figurehead, along with Kristi Noem, who runs the Department of Homeland Security, of this operation in Minnesota. He's been the public face of it. He's been speaking to the media. He's been really one of the first to react after we saw these two deadly shootings of U.S. citizens here. And he's now on the way out. The Trump administration, they made this announcement. He'll be taking some of his agents along with him as well. And I think he's seen as maybe more hard-line than some of the other figures in the administration. There's a feeling that, you know, obviously this has gone too far. The White House now may be trying to walk this back. In place of him, they're bringing in Tom Homan, who is Donald Trump's border czar, so kind of broadly in charge of border policy, immigration policy. He's been much less visible recently. That could be because the crossings at the border are way down. Maybe there's less of a role for him. But the feeling was he was sidelined within the Trump administration, a bit more of a moderate voice, perhaps. He's being brought in, somebody that I think Donald Trump hopes can maybe take control of the situation, take control of the narrative, the way that we've heard these two U.S. citizens, Alex Preddy, Renee Good, demonized, blamed for these shootings. And look, there are different narratives, of course, based on these videos about what took place. But right now, I think they want to get the situation under control. Tom Homan might be the person the administration thinks to do that. But I think this is being seen among the demonstrators that we've talked to and that we've seen on the streets of Minneapolis, at least as a small victory for them right now.
And as you drive the streets of that city, as you talk to those demonstrators, how would you describe the mood?
You know, we've been down to the memorial site. This is the site where the shooting of Alex Preddy took place every day here since that event happened. We've been speaking with people. There's so much emotion there. This is a memorial that just keeps growing of concentric rings of flowers and candles and cards and signs. That's kind of the epicenter there of this pure emotion. But on a whole, this is really a community that's on edge. And we see that when we talk to people. Sometimes, you know, we'll be sitting in our car actually parked near a demonstration or near the memorial site. They'll come up and ask us, hey, where are you from? You know, we have out-of-state license plates on a rental car. Are you an ICE agent? And that just gives you a sense of the suspicion right now, the lack of trust among regular American citizens for people who are federal agents. You know, technically they work for them, right? You know, they pay their salaries through their taxes. But there's a very big lack of trust, a fear in the community because what they've seen take place on their streets.
Carl Nasman, BBC reporter in Minneapolis. Thanks for joining us.
It's 14 minutes past six. Welsh Senedd members will vote on their budget today. Daniel Davies joins us, BBC Wales political correspondent. Morning.
Morning, Anna.
Why is this budget, well, any budget, I suppose, is important politically, but tell us more about this one.
Well, this is the last budget of this Senedd term, the final budget before elections take place, as it happens, in exactly 100 days' time. And those looming elections have really driven the entire budget process. However, the Finance Secretary, Mark Drakeford, has specifically said that this is not a pre-election giveaway budget. There are no late tax cuts or spending commitments specifically designed to woo voters. On the other hand, he said there aren't any hidden traps either for an incoming government. He says he wants that next government to have maximum freedom, so he set some money aside for the next administration to spend. He's written a one-year spending plan worth about £27 billion. He says going beyond that into a second or third year would not be democratically advisable, which I think is interesting language. It's not conceding the election, but certainly not taking it for granted that his Welsh Labour Party will be back in office. This is a party that has won every Senedd election since devolution began a quarter of a century ago. It's dominated Welsh politics for 100 years. But at the moment, Labour is struggling in the opinion polls. There haven't been that many opinion polls in Wales, but those that have been published recently show a trend emerging whereby Reform UK and in particular Plaid Cymru are way ahead of Labour at the moment. Now, it's Plaid Cymru that has negotiated this budget deal with the minority Labour government. Labour doesn't have the numbers in the Senedd to win this vote, so it's been forced to talk to its opponents. The deal with Plaid Cymru is targeted at waiting times in the NHS and at council tax. There's some more money here for local government with the intention of limiting rises to council tax. There is, however, still some concern among council leaders about their finances. And on the NHS, with waiting times in Wales so stubbornly high, there's been some analysis from the Institute of Fiscal Studies that says whoever wins that election is very likely going to have to find more funding again for the health service.
Daniel Davies, BBC Wales political correspondent. Thank you.
It is 16 minutes past six. Since the day he returned to the Oval Office, President Trump has been highly critical of Jerome Powell as chair of the Federal Reserve, raising questions about the independence of the US Central Bank. It's going to be the focus again over the next couple of days, as it looks, Will, as if he might be naming the successor finally.
Well, yes. Morning both, by the way. Yes, we've heard January, the end of January, being named multiple times by the president. We obviously haven't got very many days in January left for him to fill in there, but also potentially in terms of a flashpoint for those tensions you talk about, Nick, we've got an interest rate decision in the United States tomorrow as well, and that is, of course, where this huge falling out, this schism between Jerome Powell and President Trump stems from. Yes, plenty going on in the United States this week for markets to look at in particular as well. In a moment, we're going to hear from Randy Crozen, a former board member at the Federal Reserve, but first, Tinica Frika, our markets guest here in the studio this morning, senior fund manager at W1M, really has shaped all sorts of, not just stocks and shares, but right across financial markets right in the last few weeks, this kind of tensions between the White House and the Federal Reserve.
Yes, good morning. Yeah, so it is widely expected that US rates will be on hold on Wednesday. But indeed, the independence of the Federal Reserve, the increased sort of geopolitical risks that we've seen from the US government has just meant that the market has been concerned about this uncertainty. So and if we look at where people see safe havens, and it's interesting that gold, for example, the last 12 months is up 78%, silver 220%. So this heightened uncertainty means that investors try to find safe havens.
And also what's been going on with the US dollar affecting not just the US economy, of course, as well as a result.
Absolutely. So what will happen to the US debt under the current government, and indeed how much trust is there in the US dollar, and that also means that precious metals look attractive.
Well, let's have a look at how close we might be or not to a decision then. Randy Crozen, as I say, is with us, Professor of Economics at the University of Chicago and a former board member at the Federal Reserve. Randy, morning.
Good morning.
From what you're hearing then, you move in these kind of circles. Are they going to get through that deadline by the end of January, do you think, for naming a potential successor?
Oh, I think it's really up to the president to decide what is going to get the most attention. He really kind of thinks about this as an opportunity for focusing on issues related to the Fed. He may do it this week, but he might wait.
How important do you think who it is for those questions around independence at central banks, full stop, not just at the Fed?
Well, I think it's very important that a really well-qualified candidate is chosen, is nominated, and goes through the full Senate confirmation process. And I think that's a good way that we have in the U.S. to ensure that a very capable and competent candidate gets through. And I think that's exactly what I'm expecting.
If Tinnick is right, and do you share that belief, by the way, that you think that the bank will hold interest rates on Wednesday?
Yes.
But if that is the case, that is going to potentially spark another flashpoint here, isn't it? How complicated is that for the U.S. economy?
Oh, I think people can get it all in knots over 0.25%, but if the U.S. economy is really on edge for 0.25%, then the economy is much weaker than we think it is. So I do think it is an issue. We have to think about whether the labor market is weakening or not. There are a lot of signs that it may be. Inflation has sort of basically been kind of flat over the last year, hasn't been very, very slow to come down to the 2% target. And so this is why there's a debate, because you could say, well, do we have to be in advance of a labor market weakening, or should it be a little bit tougher to make sure we get to that 2% target more rapidly?
Do you have a view on who might be best to achieve that of the runners and riders? You've worked with a number of these guys.
Oh, yes. And you think I'm going to make enemies of all of them? I think there are a lot of excellent candidates who are there. And I think, as I said, I think the Senate confirmation process is a very important check on these things. People worry a lot about the independence of the Fed. And I said the three key checks are the three S's. One is the Supreme Court, because, of course, there have been some there'll be an important Supreme Court decision about the president's ability to remove members of the Fed board, the Senate confirmation process, and also I think someone who's very important is Scott Bessent, the third S, the Secretary of Treasury, who I think has the president's ear to make sure that good choices are made.
And a potential looming another shutdown as well around the US government's funding, particularly for the Department of Homeland Security, given everything that's been going on in Minneapolis as well. Is that another sort of outrider here of tensions ahead and things that whoever the new chair is, we're going to have to deal with going forward potentially?
Yeah, that fiscal uncertainty is something that's very, very important. I mean, obviously, many countries are having very, very high deficits and debt relative to GDP. And ultimately, it's the central banks who have to deal with the fallout of fiscal policy and other actions from their government. So obviously, this is something that the Fed would have to take into account.
Randy, thanks as always for your time. Randy Croton there, professor in economics at the University of Chicago and a former economist at the Federal Reserve. Tinnick Afrika, as I said, is still here with us, our markets guest this morning, senior fund manager at W1M. Should we turn to domestic matters? British Retail Consortium looking at shop price inflation up higher than expected.
Yeah, no, that's right. And it's particularly high in food price inflation. So food price inflation came in at 3.9% year on year. And only a month ago, it was 3.3%. So the Bank of England is hoping that inflation has peaked last year. The numbers that we saw this morning suggest that they haven't. So we need to see services inflation to come in. But nevertheless, this is a data point that shows that, A, the cost of living is moving up and inflation is maybe not under control yet.
And as we were hearing from Michael Saunders on the programme last week, former Bank of England rate setter, that inflation is still pretty stuck as well.
Yeah.
Turning back to the stock market again, CoreWeave, this company is absolutely fascinating, kind of barometer of everything that's going on in AI, isn't it? A little bit. I mean, they ostensibly just have massive warehouses full of chips, NVIDIA chips often. So slightly strange puzzling, perhaps, that Nvidia now wants to invest £2 billion in them.
Yeah, there's more questions than answers on this deal. So CoreWeave was up 8% and Nvidia was down 1% on the announcement. So yes, Nvidia bought $2 billion worth of shares of CoreWeave. They already own quite a bit, so they now own 11%. So presumably the people think that Nvidia believes in the in the future of CoreWeave, but it all seems a bit circular because it means that CoreWeave is a customer of NVIDIA and needs to buy lots of NVIDIA's chips. And NVIDIA is also a customer of CoreWeave and will buy a lot of cloud services from them, in fact, more than their annual sales. And it's going to help build these data centers. It's going to help them finance finding land quicker. So it's all... not sure why NVIDIA needs to do this, what return they get on it.
Yeah, interesting number of questions for investors this morning. Tinica, thanks so much for your time. Tinica Freaker, their senior fund manager at W1M. Well, the pressure continues on our pubs and hospitality sector, it seems. Certainly the owner of Revolution de Cuba and Peach Pubs going into administration this morning suggests that, putting as many as 2,000 jobs at risk in its 62 premises across the UK as well. We're awaiting those details, potentially as soon as later on today, on what relief, if any, the government may give to the pub sector around those changes to their business rates. But also, there seems to be a double whammy for some pubs, particularly those that show sport, because linked to their rateable value is the rate that they pay for to show channels like Sky and TNT, with their fees set in line with the venue's rateable value. Chris Tullock is with us, Managing Director at Blind Tiger Inns, runs 24 pubs across the northwest of England. Chris, morning.
Morning, Will.
So just explain that for people then. So your bill for showing the football, say, across your pubs, and you've got a lot in pretty football-mad places, goes up alongside your rateable value?
It's set on the rateable value, so it's all in a parameter table, and the difference between one of our lower rateable value pubs, where we'd pay about £20,000 a year for Sky and BT Sport, up to just over £50,000 at one of our higher rateable value sites. So yeah, it's all linked.
So if your rates go up in April, your bills for that would go up. Do you know what too?
No, we don't know yet. What would usually happen is that the Sky Sports and TNT would do a new rate card at a time. So it wouldn't instantly go up, but it certainly is a challenge that's looming, along with all the other challenges.
Because this is big money. I mean, what is it to your group across the year?
We're just over almost £450,000 for the Sky and TNT now.
Yeah.
And 24 pubs.
And presumably you're locked in all year, right, when they're not showing football necessarily as well.
Oh, yeah, we love that. but, yeah, when it's not football season, it's not, the other sports aren't massively appealing to our customers. So, yeah, it's a big cost anyway, and it's an even bigger cost when you're not driving footfall on the back of that expenditure.
So it adds to that wider pressure around the business rates picture. Have you heard anything from the government, from your local MP, about what might be happening?
No, of course not. We're very much in the dark about the lifeline that we might be getting as pubs, which still seems like a very strange analogy, given that they're causing the problem in the first place, and now the potential backtrack, if you will, is being called a rescue deal, a lifeline and a bailout. And to me, that doesn't really fit with what's happening.
Chris, thanks so much for your time this morning. Chris Tullock, the Managing Director at Blind Tiger Inns, should say Anna as well. We spoke to both TNT and Sky, sorry. Sky Business spokesperson said, "We're honouring all our existing customer agreements using the current rateable values they are on. We regularly review our pricing in line with evolving market conditions and would always update customers on price increases." TNT declined to comment, but it's understood no decision on pricing been made for next season yet.
Thank you. Well, it's 27 minutes past six. Time for the sport. Morning, Carthy.
Morning. Thank you very much. We have reached the quarterfinal stage of the first tennis Grand Slam of the season on a day where temperatures are soaring in Melbourne. The BBC's tennis correspondent Russell Fuller can bring us up to date on the tennis and, I guess, on the weather as well, Russell.
Yes, Carthy, the weather is very much the story of this Tuesday, because at 1:30 in the afternoon, the roof on the Rod Laver Arena was closed when the heat stress scale reached the magic number of 5. The temperature at the time was 38 Celsius. Half an hour or so ago, we peaked at 42.7 degrees with a hair drier hot wind. Arina Sabalenka had to play under the worst of the conditions before the roof closed, but it didn't stop the world number one reaching a 14th Grand Slam semi-final as she beat the American teenager Iva Jovic 6-3, 6-love. And Alex Zverev has recently reached a fourth Australian Open semi-final. He's beaten the young American Lerner Tien in four sets. And still to come in the night session, and the roof will almost certainly be closed for the first of the matches, which is Coco Gauff against Elina Svitolina. And then, can Alex Dimonor of Australia reach a first Grand Slam semi-final by knocking out the world number one Carlos Alcaraz?
Thank you very much, Russell Fuller. And Tennis Breakfast over on Five Sports Extra from 7 o'clock with commentary of those matches. And he just mentioned Carlos Alcaraz there, the world number one. He's trying to complete the career Grand Slam at the age of 22. And Alcaraz has been talking about playing under the roof in today's 45-degree heat later.
You got to get used to everything. So, you know, I have to control the things that I can control. It is going to be really, really hot on Tuesday and the roof is going to be closed. I got to be accepted that and just trying to play my best tennis, you know, on whatever it is. I will be ready. I will be focused. I will try not to think about it. I will try not to affect my game at all.
Tierno Barry scored his fourth goal in five Premier League games to claim a point for Everton against Leeds last night. The 1-1 draw moves Everton up to 10th place, but their manager David Moyes wants their home form to improve.
Well, I said last week, you know, if you're an Everton supporter, you'd be better being an away supporter at the moment because our form's very good away from home. We need to get back to winning ways here, but we started here very well. We're just finding it a little bit more difficult, but it's also been partly in the month or so we've had so many injuries and boys out at different times has not made it easy for us.
And England's men's cricketers play their decisive third one-day international against Sri Lanka in Colombo that starts at 9 a.m. this morning.
Cathy, thank you. Tomorrow morning, Radio 4 gets inside the business of AI.
Is the AI industry set for a crash?
The amount of money that's been pushed into this is immense.
It's all based on hype.
I'm Alex Kratosky.
And I'm Kevin Fong.
And we'll examine whether we're witnessing an economic AI bubble that is about to burst.
Surely someone somewhere is making a buck.
Yeah, I mean, there are tons of billionaires on paper.
And whether the AI dream would survive it.
The idea of artificial intelligence is magical.
The Artificial Human on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Starting tomorrow at 3:30.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Anna Foster. And at just after 6:30, it's time for a summary of the news from Caroline Nichols.
Some of the federal agents who have been carrying out an immigration crackdown in Minneapolis are to start leaving. The city's Democratic mayor says he's spoken to President Trump and that he'd agreed that the present situation cannot continue. There'd been a backlash over the fatal shooting of Alex Preti on Saturday. Those leaving Minneapolis include the Border Patrol commander, Gregory Bovino. Around 50 Labour MPs have written to the Prime Minister urging him to rethink blocking Andy Burnham from standing as an MP. They warned the decision was a real gift to Nigel Farage. Sir Keir Starmer said allowing Mr Burnham to resign as the Mayor of Greater Manchester to contest the Gorton and Denton by-election would have diverted resources from other key elections. New drivers in Northern Ireland who pass their test will do so with a graduated driving licence from October, putting limits on night-time driving and the carrying of passengers. It's the first part of the UK to introduce restrictions. The aim is to cut the number of young drivers involved in serious and fatal crashes. BBC News understands the government will today announce a cap on ground rents paid by leaseholders in England and Wales. Labour's election manifesto promised to tackle unregulated charges affecting some 5 million homes, mainly flats. The Joseph Rowntree Foundation says 6.8 million people in Britain are living in very deep poverty, warning ministers that more action is needed to tackle the problem. The government says it's taking steps to reduce poverty, including removing the two-child benefit cap, which ministers say will lift hundreds of thousands of children out of poverty from April. A large UK study has found that the menopause can cause a loss of grey matter in women's brains, affecting memory and emotions similar to that seen in Alzheimer's. The researchers from the University of Cambridge say the results suggest the menopause takes a toll on the brain and that the changes might partly explain why women are generally at greater risk of dementia than men.
Thank you, Caroline. It's 27 minutes to seven. Sir Keir Starmer is heading to China. It's the first time a British Prime Minister has visited Beijing since Theresa May went there back in 2018. So a few years now. Laura Bicker is our China correspondent. Laura, before we talk about the challenges and the opportunities, what exactly will this visit entail?
So from my understanding, there's going to be at least some announcements on business deals. There may even be discussions about giving people from Britain visa-free travel to China. And there could be significant trade announcements between the two sides. I think there's still details being hammered out from some of the conversations I've had. But in terms of kind of trade, I think that's where both sides want to focus.
Yeah. And as we said, there'll be some conversations which will be quite easy, quite cordial, some which, if they're raised by the Prime Minister, might be a little bit more tense and frosty. Just talk us through some of that.
So I think this is one of the things that is quite interesting from a Beijing perspective, because obviously, you know, you're there in the United Kingdom reading headlines about this visit. And I think when it comes to what Sir Keir Starmer has to say to Beijing, I think they will just brush it away. I think if he brings up human rights, if he brings up Hong Kong, if he brings up Jimmy Lai, if he brings up these thorny issues, I think Beijing at this time will bat it away. This is a China that has become more confident in the last few years, especially after, in the last 12 months, having fought a trade war with the United States, which China believes it resolutely has done well and has almost won. It's brought that trade war back to a truce. This is a country that believes it's a manufacturing powerhouse, not just in the goods that it sends around the world, but in renewable energy, in the likes of AI and elsewhere, in these kind of new productive technologies, as they're called here. So I think when it comes to these discussions, China feels that it's in a dominant and confident position. And so Keir Starmer joins a kind of parade of world leaders that we've seen make a path to Beijing in the last few months alone, from Emmanuel Macron to Mark Carney just in the last few weeks. So I think when it comes to Beijing's position, they will certainly listen to Sir Keir Starmer, but I think they will brush that off and move towards more comfortable ground.
Interesting. Laura Bicker, our China correspondent, thank you very much. We'll delve a little more deeply into the approach that the Prime Minister might need to take at 8:10. We'll have Sir Jeremy Hunt and Lord Sedwell with us to discuss that.
It's coming up to 24 minutes to seven now. About 50 Labour MPs have signed a letter protesting against the decision to block Greater Manchester's Mayor Andy Burnham from running in a parliamentary by-election. Our Chief Political Correspondent Henry Zeffman joins us. Is 50 enough to change any minds in Downing Street, or will they simply brush it aside, Henry?
I think they'll brush it aside, Nick. This letter is to Shabana Mahmood in her capacity, not as Home Secretary, but also as Chair of the National Executive Committee. This letter says that the decision that was made by a sub-panel of the National Executive Committee on Sunday is a real gift to Reform UK, that Andy Burnham could have been Labour's very best chance at winning the Gorton and Denton by-election. And the specific demand is that the full National Executive Committee re-evaluate this decision rather than that subgroup. I mean, I think there are some reasons to just have a little bit of scepticism about this letter. The first thing is that the organisers say they have around 50 Labour MPs, but they're not putting their names to it in public. And when it came to a meeting of the Parliamentary Labour Party yesterday, just a couple of MPs raised this issue. Also, all the signs are that if the full National Executive did meet, then Andy Burnham would still have been blocked, though definitely by a narrower margin than the 8-1 margin that you got on the officers' subgroup. However, it is clearly the case that there is ill will swilling around the Parliamentary Labour Party that was already there but has been very much intensified by the decision of the weekend. And I think all of that could well come to a head if, at the by-election, which is less than a month away, February the 26th, the Labour Party candidate, who will not be Andy Burnham, doesn't win.
What's fascinating, Henry, about this is the defeatism, isn't it? The number of people in this conversation on both sides of the argument who seem to assume they will lose the by-election and indeed assume that it will be Nigel Farage's Reform UK that will win it.
Absolutely right. And there are some people I was speaking to who know this part of the world in the Labour Party yesterday who were raising the possibility that the Labour Party candidate could come third, that you could end up with a Westminster version of the Caerphilly Senedd by-election in October, where where the Labour Party just becomes marginal. And in this case, it would be between Reform and the Greens rather than Reform and Plaid, as it was there back in October. I mean, one other, by the way, I think under-noticed element of the defeatism that you identify is that the public argument being advanced for blocking Andy Burnham was that the Labour Party could not risk a by-election for the Greater Manchester mayoralty because Reform might win it. The Greater Manchester mayoralty. I mean, every time that's been contested, which is only a handful of times, to be fair, the Labour candidate, Andy Burnham, has got at least 63% of the vote. And now it is the stated view of the Labour Party leadership that they can't be sure they would win it.
Henry Zuffman, thanks.
It's 22 minutes to seven. The US military has completed its move of an aircraft carrier strike group into position in the Middle East. It was rediverted from the South China Sea when President Trump talked about launching an attack on the Iranian regime. It makes that more feasible, this carrier group being there, but certainly not guaranteed. Hugo Bashaga is our Middle East correspondent. Morning, Hugo. We need to go back a couple of weeks to the point at which those protests in Iran were at their height before they were repressed by the regime with large-scale killing. And at that point, President Trump said that he was going to do something.
Yeah, Anna, and I think this is, you know, the background to all of this that is happening here, because the president had promised to hit Iran very hard if the regime killed protesters during that wave of anti-government protests a few weeks ago. He has backed away from this threat, despite the horrific accounts that have emerged, you know, detailing the brutality of the crackdown by the authorities, with human rights organizations saying that they have managed to confirm at least 6,000 deaths, but reports that this number could be much, much higher. So now we're seeing this dramatic expansion of U.S. military capabilities in the region, not only in terms of defense, but also in terms of being able to be involved in any potential attack against Iran. This doesn't mean that an attack is going to happen. It doesn't mean that an attack on Iran is imminent. We're kind of returning to the status quo here in the region. It was very unusual to have these assets in the region. And I think at the same time, Anna, I thought it was interesting that yesterday the president again appeared to suggest that there could be a diplomatic solution to this crisis. He told the Axios news service that Iran wanted to talk, that he thought that Iran wanted to make a deal. But again, the president is unpredictable. This is a trademark of his presidency, if you like. We don't know if this is, you know, President Trump trying to distract people, trying to distract the Iranian authorities, but all indications suggest that he hasn't made a decision yet. The more discussions are likely to happen this week, with some divisions inside the administration in relation to what to do with Iran.
If he did go down the military route, Hugo, as well, it would be complex. There's no simple way to get rid of the Iranian regime.
Exactly. And now we've seen, you know, the brutality of the crackdown, and, you know, the government in Iran, the regime, has managed to quell, you know, this huge wave of protests that engulfed the country a few weeks ago. And now a lot of people are questioning, you know, what kind of, what any kind of military strike would be able to achieve now after the repression by the authorities. We've seen that, you know, the regime still there. We haven't seen, you know, signs of cracks inside the regime, with, you know, the Revolutionary Guards and all the security apparatus, if you like, still supporting the regime. So lots of questions about what could happen next in terms of if the Americans were to go ahead with any kind of military strike on Iran. And obviously, you know, the targets and the consequences of those attacks, because the Iranian authorities have been insistent that they're going to respond to any kind of military attack on the country.
Hugo Bashaga, our Middle East correspondent. Thank you.
18 minutes to seven. Let's take you through a few of the front pages. A lot of politics, and what politics you're reading depends on which paper you read. So for the Daily Mail, the story is Burnham Rebellion growing. The story we're just hearing about 50 Labour MPs claim to be signing a letter of protest to the Prime Minister about the blocking of Andy Burnham. Whereas Reform is the front page story for many of the papers. Reform's latest con is the way the Daily Mirror puts it, because day after day, they want to say that, as they put it in another of the headlines, another Tory flop jumps ship. Other papers focus on what the Tories were meant to say about Suella Braverman, released it, they claim, by mistake, and then withdrew it. Tories face backlash, says The Guardian, after mental health jibe over Braverman's exit, and the iPaper headline, Tories weaponise mental health claim on defector Braverman. Matt, the cartoonist in The Telegraph, sums it up all very nicely. Link it with a story about pubs being in trouble, with a landlord offering a petition to one of his regulars saying, would you sign our petition to save crucial British institutions, the Conservative and Labour parties?
The Daily Telegraph this morning has a headline about China hacking phones inside 10 Downing Street. We're talking a lot about China on the programme this morning, about the Prime Minister's visit there, the first since Theresa May in 2018. A years-long spying operation, says the Telegraph, targeted senior figures, including aides to Boris Johnson and Rishi Sunak. And also the front page of The Times this morning is one to bookmark if, like me, you sometimes need a bit of assistance from grandparents to look after your kids. Hands-on grandparents help themselves too, says this story in the front page of The Times. Those seeking free childcare from their parents, which is a little cruel but also very true, now have an ace up their sleeve. A study has shown that looking after grandchildren is one of the best ways to stave off cognitive decline.
Come on, Gran, it's good for you.
Exactly. Yeah. Keep your kids happy.
Not
at
sure
the same
that's
time.
Work, is it? It's now 16 minutes to 7. Let's turn to events yesterday in Parliament, where the Conservatives have been accused of using parliamentary stunts to delay the deal to hand the Chagos Islands back to Mauritius. Here's our correspondent, Sean Curran.
When members of the Lords left Westminster on Friday, they expected to start this week with a debate and vote on legislation bringing into force the Chagos deal, under which the UK will lease back the British-American military base on Diego Garcia. But ministers pressed the pause button after the Conservatives tabled an amendment calling for a delay in light of what they called changing geopolitical circumstances, a diplomatic way of describing President Trump's denunciation of the deal as an act of great stupidity. A Foreign Office minister, Stephen Doughty, accused the Conservatives of trying to wreck the bill.
This is an irresponsible and reckless behaviour from the official opposition in the second house, using programming tactics to frustrate the implementation of a treaty on a critical national security matter.
He'd been called to the Commons to answer an urgent question from the Conservative Shadow Foreign Secretary, Dame Priti Patel, who said the government had pulled the bill to avoid being defeated in the Lords.
And in their rush to appease the wishes of their left-wing lawyer friends, Labour overlooked this very 1966 treaty between the UK and the US, which states that the British Indian Ocean Territory shall remain under the United Kingdom's sovereignty. So can the minister tell us, does he accept that the bill and the treaty violates this very 1966 treaty with the US?
Last week, a shadow Foreign Office minister, Lord Callanan, wrote to the government and suggested that unless that 1966 agreement was changed before the Chagos deal was ratified, the UK would be in breach of international law. As he looked on from the Peers Gallery in the Commons, Stephen Doughty told MPs the idea that ministers hadn't looked at the law was absolute nonsense.
The reality is that the tone, the braying, the noise, Mr. Speaker, I think reflects absolutely that this is a simple political stunt from the opposition.
But he didn't get any support from Labour backbenchers. The only Labour MP to speak, Dan Carden, warned the minister that he wouldn't like what he had to say.
The people we represent will be asking, why can the Prime Minister not step forward, assert sovereignty over these islands, and make clear that we have the military defence to defend them?
He sat down to loud cheers from the Conservatives.
A lot of noise from the other side, Mr. Speaker, but of course they knew the problem here. They knew the risk to the operations of the base. That's why they engaged in 11 rounds of negotiations over this, Mr. Speaker.
For the Liberal Democrats, Callum Miller said there were cross-party concerns about what he called the vast sums of public money that would be paid to Mauritius under the agreement.
We should not sign 99 cheques today that Mauritius can cash over the next century. So will the Minister support the Liberal Democrat amendment in the other place to give Parliament annual scrutiny of the payments made to Mauritius? Mr Speaker, I encourage the Minister, in light of the shifting US position, to consider soberly the approach the government is taking, and I urge him to accept the Liberal Democrat amendment in the other place for a pause while the US position is clarified.
A Conservative, Sir Julian Lewis, said the bill might be blocked as a result of Tory opposition in the Commons and the Lords.
And the work of the leader of the Reform Party in Mr Trump's ear. And doesn't this show what can be achieved when two parties make common cause in a very worthwhile aim to achieve a vital objective?
The minister was surprised.
I'm absolutely astonished. Perhaps he's next on the defection list. I mean, absolutely extraordinary comments.
Richard Tice of Reform UK attacked the Prime Minister's National Security Advisor, Jonathan Powell.
And thank heavens, the US administration have now realised that they were deliberately misled by our National Security Advisor, deliberately misled by the Foreign Office, and therefore the Speaker is listening intently.
Labour MPs had been looking at the Speaker, but Sir Lindsay Hoyle didn't intervene. Stephen Doughty called Reform UK fake patriots. A Conservative former minister, Dame Harriet Baldwin, offered the minister what she called a gentle down-ramp.
Which is just to simply not find the time in the other place to progress things and allow prorogation to just gently wash this particular piece of legislation.
Stephen Doughty said the most important thing was that the government had a deal which secured operations on Diego Garcia well into the next century. But he didn't say when peers would debate the bill.
Sean Curran reporting. It's 11 minutes to 7. The first court case in which social media companies are being sued for causing damage to a person's life and mental health because of the content that their algorithms have provided them with will start in Los Angeles today. Now, thousands of these are being brought around the world, but this is the first one to actually reach court. And I spoke earlier to Matthew Bergman, founding attorney of the Social Media Victims Law Centre, who is representing the plaintiff, a 19-year-old woman, along with other lawyers. And I asked him how her life has been affected.
She's been robbed of her childhood, her adolescence, and her teen years. She became addicted to social media at a very young age and had a very bad course of events that have affected her mental health for a very long time. I wish I could say this was a unique case. It is not. It was specifically chosen by the court because it was representative of many other cases involving young people who are so badly damaged by social media. Young people not just in the United States, but in the UK and the EU and really throughout the world.
And the fact that this particular case has got to trial makes it a significant moment.
Very significant. This is the first time that a person has ever gone to trial against a social media company in a case involving an injured young person. Really, the only other case that comes close is the Molly Russell case in the UK, where there was a coroner's inquest. But in terms of an actual civil trial, this is the first time a social media company has ever had to stand before a jury and seek to justify its conduct.
What have the social media companies said? How have they responded? Because I know that Snap settled out of court, and I believe TikTok have as well now, ByteDance, the parent company.
That is correct.
That's interesting. So who remains as part of the court case? Which companies are still there?
Meta for Instagram and Google for YouTube.
And as far as you understand it, they're not planning to settle. They are planning to continue this as a case.
That is my understanding, yes.
What is their argument? What is their case that they're making, why this wasn't their responsibility?
Well, they blame everybody else. They blame the parents, they blame the victims, they blame society, they blame COVID, anything other than their own deliberate design decisions. This is really a case of kind of passing the buck and avoiding any accountability for the clear and present danger that their platforms inflict on kids throughout the world.
There are so many things out there in the world that are dangerous for us as humans, and normally it's our own responsibility to avoid them. Why in this case does that responsibility fall to the social media companies, who often are hosting rather than creating the content themselves?
Well, for a couple of reasons. First and foremost, because the social media companies have intentionally designed their platforms to be addictive to young people. They show kids not what they want to see, but what they can't look away from. And through their engagement, their susceptibility to the advertising that these companies make billions of dollars every year from.
If you're successful in this case, it would be a real watershed moment for those companies. It would change everything.
Well, yes, but the fact that we even are at this point is a watershed moment. This is the first time a social media company has ever had to be held accountable in front of a jury. For years and years and years, they manufactured their platforms and addicted our kids with impunity. And when these cases started getting filed, and when we filed the first cases ever, people said, you'll never get to court. This is never going to happen. Well, we're in court. We're in trial. We have the opportunity to present our evidence before a fair and impartial jury. And that in and of itself is a very significant victory.
How far-reaching could the implications, the legal implications of this be if those remaining companies do take this trial all the way to conclusion? It could open up potential legal cases and significant financial damages claims from right around the world, couldn't it?
Well, it could, yes. Now, you know, this case is not precedential in a legal sense, but it certainly is precedential as an example of a company being held accountable. So it's a very, very significant moment. And it is, we hope, the first of many times when these companies are going to have to justify for the first time why their profits are more important than the lives of our kids.
That's Matthew Bergman, who's one of the lawyers representing the 19-year-old plaintiff. We approached TikTok for comment. We haven't received a statement back from them just yet. A YouTube spokesperson said that a safer, healthier experience for young people was core to their work. Their services and policies provide young people with age-appropriate experiences, robust controls for parents. They do say the allegations in these complaints are simply not true. And Meta, which owns Facebook and Instagram, said we strongly disagree with these allegations and are confident the evidence will show our long-standing commitment to supporting young people.
It is 6 minutes to seven. How can we keep people working rather than signing more and more of employees off sick? That was the question the Keep Britain Working Review, chaired by the former chair of John Lewis, Charlie Mayfield, tried to answer. We're hearing from him later in the programme. Let's hear from one of the businesses he's now working with to try and implement his idea that they, not the government, can play a critical role in keeping employees healthy. The Chief Medical Officer of EDF joins us, Sarah Jackson. And morning to you, Sarah. You were a GP. How have you reconciled yourself to the idea that it's not necessarily, you know, the NHS that should keep workers healthy? Companies have a crucial role.
Morning, Nick. Well, you're correct. I was a GP and then I retrained in a specialty called occupational medicine, which is exactly that. It's the interaction between work and health. And when you study occupational medicine, you really understand actually there is a breadth of things we can do to support people in work and to help keep people in work. And employers want to do this. EDF is a really forward-leaning company, and we really want to support our employees. But the big question is, we don't really understand why people are falling out of work or struggling with work. So we knew, for example, that we were going to have to plan for an aging population. We knew that people were going to have to stay in work longer, and we would have to manage concomitant illnesses in work. But I suppose what we didn't see coming is the younger generation having this crisis of mental health and how we support them in staying in work and or coming back to work if they've fallen out of work.
So part of what you're trying to do is, as an employer, is get to understand better why that's happening in order you can give greater support.
Absolutely. To, you know, the best part of medicine is prevention. If you can prevent, that's much more effective than treating. And one of the things that we don't have in the UK is a really good data set about the working age population and the health of the working age population. And that's why we're working with the Keep Britain Working Review. We're one of the vanguards, and you'll be hearing from Sir Charlie later that the vanguard numbers have doubled since they published the review. But employers want to do the right thing, but understanding what the problems are and what you can do to support and what is effective is absolutely key.
Just a quick last one, if you would, Sarah. I know some companies have talked of paying for private appointments for their employees to get them back to work quicker than if they sit on an NHS waiting list. Is that what you're doing?
So, yes, we definitely do have some access to private services, but obviously it is expensive and that's difficult for employers to manage, particularly smaller employers. Again, one of the things the Keep Britain Working Review is looking at is what incentives can they give employers to help manage people's workplace health. For example, you know, one of the things we struggle with is the benefit in kind of legislation, where if we were to pay for a private operation, the employee would have a tax bill, and sometimes that's unaffordable for people.
Yeah, that's one thing on the agenda for the conversation we're going to have at 10 to 8. Sarah Jackson of EDF, thanks for joining us.
This is our BBC. It can take us anywhere.
I hear we're going down the beach.
Raise questions.
So let's try and join all the dots.
Bring us down to Earth.
Floating in a spacesuit.
We can share it with others.
Children need are going to help so many people with that money.
Or keep it to ourselves.
Mr. Shelby will always be alone.
Join millions of people.
Live at the Royal Albert Hall where we are.
Building our future.
The BBC has put £5 billion into the economy.
There's a BBC for each of us, funded by all of us.
Much to discover.
This is our BBC.
Helen Willits has the weather forecast for us. Morning, Helen.
Anna, thanks. Good morning. And it's Storm Chandra. We have two amber warnings from the Met Office, which means, of course, a danger to life. And we're feeling the full force now across southwest England. Start here, because that's where we have the amber for the rain, where we've seen in excess of 100 millimetres in the last 24 hours. And already some parts have had 1.5 times their average January rainfall here. So the ground's saturated, the rivers are swollen, the flood warnings are rising. In fact, there is now one severe flood warning in force, and I expect flood warnings elsewhere to continue to rise through the day. Across England and Wales, it's pouring with rain. There's snow being reported now for the Trans-Pennine routes, so that's an added hazard, as well as those strong to gale force winds battering coastal areas in particular. But it's lively winds and heavy rain. It really will be quite an atrocious commute this morning. It does brighten later, but there are heavy, squally, thundery showers to follow from the southwest. Temperatures fairly academic at 7 to 10, and obviously lower over the higher ground. For Northern Ireland, a very similar story. We've got the amber warning here for the eastern side of Northern Ireland for the strength of the wind. Gusts already around 75 miles an hour. That's what we're talking about. Those are damaging gusts of wind with areas that have already been recently hit by strong winds and things may have been disturbed. That's a concern. Wet, windy and then showery this afternoon. Temperatures fairly academic. Snow too for the hills of Scotland, pushing northwards through the day as that rain moves its presence northwards. It's not quite with us in the northeast yet. 4 to 7 the highs, but wet, windy, wintry over the hills.
Thank you, Helen. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Nick Robinson. Good morning. It's 7 o'clock on Tuesday, the 27th of January. The headlines this morning: a commander who's become the face of Donald Trump's tough immigration policy is expected to leave Minneapolis amid signs of a climb down by the president. Dozens of Labour MPs have signed a letter objecting to the decision to block Andy Burnham from standing in a parliamentary by-election. And Northern Ireland is to become the first part of the UK to impose restrictions on newly qualified young drivers.
Coming up in the next hour of the programme, a landmark trial begins in the US today, which asks whether social media companies and their algorithms can be held responsible for causing mental health problems. The creator of the Twitter hashtag gives us his view.
I mean, it's so, in some ways, like trite and innocent in a way, looking back, but the intention was quite pure. You know, the intention was to connect with other people who were sharing similar interests and were also happening to use the internet.
And as Sir Keir Starmer prepares to become the first British Prime Minister to visit China in 8 years, we'll ask what the government in Beijing wants to get out of it. The BBC News is read by Caroline Nichols.
The Democratic mayor of Minneapolis says some federal agents will begin leaving the city after he held a call with President Trump. There's been a growing backlash to the killing of Alex Pretty on Saturday, weeks after Renee Good, another US citizen, was shot dead by immigration officers. Those leaving are expected to include the controversial Border Patrol chief, Gregory Bovino. But the Trump administration insists he's not been relieved of his duties. Our correspondent, Tom Bateman, sent this report from Minneapolis.
Agents in gas masks fired irritants towards protesters who'd gathered for what they called a goodbye Bovino noise demo, banging drums and clattering pieces of wood outside the hotel where they said the Border Patrol commander was staying. His expected departure from Minneapolis, along with some of his agents, marks a partial victory for the demonstrators and for Minnesota's Democratic leadership. The White House appears to be trying to deflect the anger over the killing of Alex Pretty by moving Mr. Bovino, who had alleged the 37-year-old nurse intended to carry out a massacre before he was shot dead, despite there being no evidence for that claim. In a shift of tone, Mr. Trump said he had good phone calls with the Democrat leadership of the city and state. The mayor of Minneapolis, Jacob Frey's statement on the call said Mr. Trump had agreed that the present situation could not continue. But this is not a retreat by the Trump administration from its deportation drive overall, with Mr. Trump sending another envoy to Minneapolis, his border czar, Tom Homan, while his press secretary continued to blame Democrats for what she called deliberate and hostile resistance.
Around 50 Labour MPs have written to the Prime Minister and the chair of the party's National Executive Committee, calling on them to rethink the decision to block Andy Burnham from standing to be an MP. Sir Keir Starmer has defended the decision, claiming that allowing Mr. Burnham to stand down as the Mayor of Greater Manchester in order to contest the Gorton and Denton by-election would have diverted resources away from other crucial elections. Here's our political correspondent, Jack Fenwick.
The MPs who signed the letter said the decision to block Andy Burnham caused a huge amount of anxiety and anger among colleagues. The number of names suggests those feelings go beyond the so-called usual suspects. They warned the Prime Minister that the decision was a real gift to Nigel Farage and said losing the upcoming by-election would be unimaginable. Labour won the seat in 2024 with a 13,000 majority, but Reform and the Greens are both expected to be much more competitive this time round. It had widely been expected that if Andy Burnham won the seat, it could open the door to him challenging Sir Keir for the Labour leadership later this year. The former Labour cabinet minister, Baroness Harman, told BBC Newsnight that her parliamentary colleagues should move on and focus on winning the by-election instead of discussing the decision to block Mr. Burnham.
BBC News understands the government will today announce a cap on ground rents paid by leaseholders in England and Wales. Labour's election manifesto promised to tackle unregulated charges affecting some 5 million homes, mainly flats. There had been concerns the government could retreat from the pledge due to the potential impact on pension funds. Our housing correspondent Tara Welsh reports.
A ground rent is ultimately the fee paid by millions of homeowners for the ground beneath their buildings. The need for it and cost has long been disputed. The English Housing Survey estimates leaseholders pay a median annual ground rent of £120 a year, but many have complained about not being able to sell their home because the costs keep going up. Labour promised to tackle the issue in its manifesto. Building owners have argued that a cap would damage investor confidence in the UK housing market. And recent reports have suggested the Treasury and the Housing Department have been at loggerheads over the issue, with concerns over how a cap would impact pension funds, which own some freeholds. Leasehold campaigner Sebastian O'Kelly says the effect on pension funds would be minimal, and it's the rich benefiting from ground rents.
In a UK first, new drivers in Northern Ireland who pass their test are to get a graduated driving licence, which puts restrictions on carrying passengers at night. It's hoped the measure will help reduce the number of fatal and serious road traffic accidents involving new and young drivers. Sarah Gervin reports.
Graduated driving licences are already used in countries including Canada, Australia and New Zealand, and from October they'll be introduced in Northern Ireland. The plan means that new drivers will have to learn for a mandatory period of 6 months before being able to take a practical test. There will be restrictions on driving at night for those aged under 24, with just one passenger aged between 14 and 20 allowed. An exemption will apply for family members. The nighttime rules will be in place between 11 p.m. and 6 a.m. Those behind the plan say they hope the licences will help save lives by producing more skilled motorists. The first new graduated driving licence holders will be on the road in April 2027.
The lower house of the French Parliament, the National Assembly, has backed a social media ban for children under the age of 15. President Macron wants France to follow Australia, which last month became the first country to introduce a similar ban. The bill will now pass to the Senate before a final vote in the National Assembly. A new report has suggested Britain's poorest people are getting poorer. The Joseph Rowntree Foundation found that almost 7 million people were living in what it called very deep poverty and warned ministers that more action was needed to tackle the problem. The government said decisive action was being taken to address poverty. More details from our social affairs correspondent, Michael Buchanan.
The report says that a record 6.8 million people were living in what's classed as very deep poverty, meaning their incomes after housing costs were less than 40% of the UK average. The analysis also found getting a job was no guarantee of prosperity, with more than 5 million adults in poverty living in households where someone works. The Foundation say these figures, for the 12 months to the end of March 2024, would be the baseline against which the Labour government would be judged. The researchers welcomed the decision by ministers to remove the two-child limit on benefits, which they say would lift 400,000 children out of poverty from April. But the Foundation argued that more action on housing, jobs and benefits was needed if further progress was to be made.
Storm Chandra is causing travel disruption as heavy rain and strong winds hit the UK. Roads have flooded in South Wales. The M48 Severn Bridge is closed, with restrictions also in place on the Humber Bridge, and South Western Railway services may also be affected. A large UK study has found that the menopause can cause a loss of grey matter in women's brains, affecting memory and emotions similar to that seen in Alzheimer's. It's been published in the journal Psychological Medicine. The changes it found might partly explain why women are generally at greater risk of dementia than men. Here's our health reporter, Michelle Roberts.
The study involved nearly 125,000 UK women, of whom 11,000 had MRI brain scans, and the results suggest the menopause takes a toll on the brain, even with hormone replacement therapy treatment. The regions affected are similar to those impacted in Alzheimer's disease. The researchers from Cambridge University say the findings might help shed light on why dementia is twice as common in women than in men. But more studies are needed to better understand how menopause impacts the brain and what, if anything, could be done about it.
The Jamaican drummer and music producer Sly Dunbar has died at the age of 73. He was one of the most revered figures in reggae, but after performing on Bob Marley classics, he also went on to work with artists ranging from Bob Dylan to Grace Jones.
Caroline, thank you. It's now 9 minutes past seven. Greg Bovino, the commander of Donald Trump's controversial and deadly immigration crackdown, appears to relish his notoriety, filming promotional videos sporting a buzz cut, wearing an olive-green army greatcoat, marching alongside masked and heavily armed officers set to heavy metal music. His critics accuse him of self-consciously adopting a Nazi aesthetic. Now Bovino looks set to leave the state of Minnesota after he claimed that the nurse who was shot dead by officers of ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, wanted to massacre federal agents. There are signs that all this has gone too far, even for some of Donald Trump's supporters. When the candidate to be the next governor of Minnesota, Republican Chris Madel, withdrew from the race last night. Madel is no bleeding-heart liberal. As a lawyer, he volunteered to represent the ICE officer who shot dead Rene Good earlier this month. Here's an extract from the video he posted announcing his decision.
Driving while Hispanic is not a crime. Either is driving while Asian. At the end of the day, I have to look my daughters in the eye and tell them I believe I did what was right. And I am doing that today.
I've been speaking to Tom Bateman, our correspondent in Minneapolis, who told me why Chris Madel's decision to withdraw from the Republican candidacy to be governor is so significant.
Firstly, as you've pointed out, he is a senior Republican in the state of Minnesota. And so to have him very publicly in a video online calling ICE operations, you know, all directed from the top of the Trump administration, an unmitigated disaster, saying it's expanded well beyond its stated focus, you know, that matters. And clearly he feels strongly enough about this that he has pulled out of the race. But the other point is, he's a Minnesota attorney. He had given legal counsel to Jonathan Ross, who was the ICE agent who had shot dead Rene Good, who, you know, was killed nearly 3 weeks ago now, and he'd actually sort of risen to prominence because of that fact and become quite controversial because of it. So you're seeing, you know, both senior Republicans across the states now, including the Oklahoma governor, for example, openly expressing criticism, concern about the Trump administration's approach here. And, you know, I think the White House and Mr. Trump himself, who's always, the radar is always switched on to what the base is feeling. And, you know, I think they know that his poll rating is suffering because of this immigration drive.
All this crucial context for the decision of Greg Bovino, a hugely controversial figure, to leave the state.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, we've just been down at a hotel where the protesters say he is staying, and decided, you know, well over 100 of them tonight to show up and give him a send-off in the form of clattering drums and banging pieces of wood together. Now, it was, I mean, basically, this was a peaceful protest. Some people had taken it a bit far in terms of hitting one of the signs at the car park of the hotel. But then we saw masked agents with tear gas rifles and other sort of irritant guns show up, and the situation really quickly escalated, firing some of that irritant into the crowd. It was very hard to breathe. They were pushing people back, and then I was seeing, you know, at least one person sort of dragged over towards these federal agents. So, you know, although it feels like there is a toning down of the rhetoric, both from the White House and the Democrat leadership here, you know, certainly a sense that the mood on the streets is you know, in itself, tensions are staying pretty high, and that felt like it was escalating tonight.
Donald Trump may be recalibrating, but he's not going to abandon the search for people on the streets, is he?
No, I mean, you know, it was an absolute core election pledge. The things always struck me is many Republicans were sort of very satisfied with the closure of the southern border. So they're seeing apprehensions in terms of illegal crossings have simply dropped to near zero. But this issue about what they're seeing on their TV screens, on their social media feeds of people being dragged off the streets, and this very sort of visible campaign of ICE agents in tactical gear, I mean, that is playing a bit differently. So I think he's still attuned to that. At the moment, the signalling is it will continue, but I think with a very different sort of public messaging, he wants to appear much more conciliatory. But there's still no sign, as you point out, that the policy itself is going to change.
Tom Bateman, our correspondent in Minneapolis.
It's 14 minutes past seven. Ground rents will be capped at £250 a year for leaseholders in England and Wales as part of changes that have been announced by the government just this morning, Will.
That's right, Anna, yes. Perhaps in a nod to who the government thinks this might help. The Prime Minister, in fact, has just announced this on TikTok this morning. I've spoken to so many people who say this will make a difference to them, worth hundreds of pounds, he says. Mercifully, no dancing to go along with it. New leasehold flats will be banned, and existing leaseholders will get the right to switch to common hold in a bid to give homeowners greater control over their properties. Daniel Stern is with us, heads the property litigation team at the law firm Slater Helis. Daniel, morning.
Good morning.
This sounds complicated to try and retrofit then to lots and lots of prior agreements.
Yes. The first point I think I should make is that when Labour were in opposition in 2024, Matthew Pennycook, who is now the housing minister, he said then that Labour would take steps to make ground rent zero. Now, obviously, they're sort of striking a halfway balance between zero and having ground rents, but no longer escalating or doubling ground rents.
Yeah, let's come to that in a moment. Just the complications from a legal perspective.
From a legal perspective, this is going to be retrofitting it, as you say, to existing contracts. What they're going to have to say is that there's legislation that they're going to bring through, which will effectively cap the ground rents at £250, irrespective of what the lease between the leaseholder and the tenant, between the leaseholder and the freeholder says at the moment. This is going to cause uproar in the markets, as you can imagine.
Yeah, and presumably part of the pushback right to the so-called peppercorn rents, the sort of nominal rent rates that you were talking about, and this £250 figure, is that reaction. Already had a statement through from the Residential Freehold Association. A retrospective cap on contractually payable ground rent would remove the financial foundations of the organisations the government is relying upon to deliver its priorities, weakening and in some cases disabling delivery of building safety, remediation and other strategic programmes. I mean, is that a real risk?
Yeah, it certainly is. These people, these pension funds who've brought these ground rents, they've done it relying on an income stream. That income stream is now being taken away from them. almost all taken away from it. It's going to be restricted to £250, but many of these people predicted escalating ground rents, which would improve their investment, and obviously it will affect all of us indirectly.
Do you suspect then there's going to be plenty of legal challenge ahead, Daniel?
I think the government has predicted the legal challenge already. They initially came out and said it would be zero. They're hoping to strike a halfway balance here to keep the pension funds happy and the leaseholders happy. But I have no doubt that there will be still be legal challenge to this.
Daniel Stern, head of the property litigation team at the law firm Slater Helis, thanks so much for your time.
Well, thanks.
It is 17 minutes past seven. Sir Keir Starmer's heading to China. It's the first time a British Prime Minister has visited Beijing since Theresa May in 2018. And it comes, of course, at a time of growing geopolitical tensions. It's a key moment, really, in sketching out what the future UK-China relationship will look like. Dr. Yu Ji is Senior Research Fellow on China at Chatham House. Good morning.
Good morning.
We talk about relationships as there are diplomatic relationships and trade relationships. For some countries, they're all wrapped up together, but not really for China.
Not really for China. And I think for the UK's case in here is really for this visit, for this particular visit after 8 years' absence of the British Prime Minister, is essentially about keeping the dialogue of China for diplomacy open. I think that's the key for a Prime Minister's visit for this time.
How is this being talked about in China, if at all?
Quite rarely. I mean, really compare with, for example, the announcement of the Canadian Prime Minister or the Finnish Prime Minister. I think the Chinese Foreign Ministry barely mentioned what's the exact plan for the British Prime Minister to visit Beijing and Shanghai and who will meet. I think until this day, the details of the visit have not really been fully confirmed.
We don't know if Sir Keir Starmer will raise issues that might cause tensions, things like human rights in Hong Kong, things like the jailing of Jimmy Lai. If he does, what kind of response is China likely to give to the starting of a conversation like that?
Well, I think if the Prime Minister raised such thorny issues to Beijing, and certainly will have a very firm response from the Chinese side. I mean, this is just the standard practice. However, I think this trip is beyond just a security discussion, but equally, I think Prime Minister want to do a showcase that if Labour government is truly concerned about prosperity generation by going to China, is part of his commitment and try to fulfill that sense of prosperity generation by tap into the world's second largest economy. So I think for this trip, there's a tricky balance to be made between, on the one hand, address the security concern, whereas on the other hand, and to see what are the real opportunities for the British economy towards China.
Even as you're speaking, I'm just looking. The Chinese Foreign Ministry have just released a statement about the visit. China is ready to use this visit as an opportunity to enhance political mutual trust with the UK, deepen practical cooperation, jointly open a new chapter in the sound and stable development of China-UK relations. Very much as you were saying there, Doctor, it will be, as you say, trade is a particularly key element in all of this as well.
Trade will be very much the key element. I think the key thing in here is that even though China had quite bitter disputes on the trade surplus issues with France and Germany, however, the British economy and the Chinese economy are quite complementary. They're not competing on the same thing in the international market. So in a way, the UK would have more autonomy in terms of asking terms and conditions with China when it comes to the trade negotiation compared with the continental European countries.
The final line in that statement talks about contributing actively and responsibly to global peace, security and stability. Might that be a nod towards the US?
Well, it's a nod towards US, but I think this also implies that China would sit itself standing a very stark contrast compared with the United States by being some kind of stable force to provide peace and security to global affairs. But however, how much the two countries can realistically collaborate, I have some doubt in here. Because overall, United States still kept a very much a special relationship with the UK. And so does UK appreciate this very much. So any British foreign policy would really derive from allies first, and then followed by other economic and political partners. So obviously China by no way, by being very close economic partners or political partners with the UK. So I think if the two countries could develop some kind of normal trade and economic relationship, that is already a surplus.
Yeah. Dr. Yuji, thank you very much for joining us.
It is now 21 minutes past seven. Over the last few weeks, we've been hearing from some of the country's best known authors on the book that ignited or reignited their love of reading as part of our series marking the National Year of Reading. Today, it's the turn of Alan Hollinghurst, the 2004 Booker Prize winning novelist, known for works including The Swimming Pool Library and The Line of Beauty. He's chosen for us The Lord of the Rings by J.R.R. Tolkien. He reads from the first book in the series, The Fellowship of the Ring, first published in 1954 by George Allen and Unwin.
I was a keen reader all my childhood, but at the age of 11, I discovered The Lord of the Rings by J.R.R. Tolkien. And I think it was a sort of transitional moment for me. It drew me not only into a story, but into a whole other world, one which I continued to explore and inhabit for several years to come. As a writer myself, I don't think I've been influenced much by Tolkien at all, but the world that he created continues to live in my mind, and I'm still, 60 years on, visited by little shivers of the Tolkien mood in a particular light, a particular landscape. The mood of the story comes back to me in a way that I think no other book that I've read does. I'm going to read a passage from the first chapter of the first book, The Fellowship of the Ring, where Bilbo Baggins, the hobbit, is giving a big party to celebrate his 11th birthday, and he's making quite a long speech. "Thirdly and finally," he said, "I wish to make an announcement." He spoke this last word so loudly and suddenly that everyone sat up who still could. "I regret to announce that, though, as I said, 11 years is far too short a time to spend among you, this is the end. I'm going. I'm leaving now. Goodbye." He stepped down and vanished. There was a blinding flash of light, and the guests all blinked. When they opened their eyes, Bilbo was nowhere to be seen. 144 flabbergasted hobbits sat back speechless. As for Bilbo, even while he was making his speech, he had been fingering the golden ring in his pocket, his magic ring that he had kept secret for so many years. As he stepped down, he slipped it on his finger, and he was never seen by any hobbit in Hobbiton again. Tolkien is a marvellous storyteller. He writes in a style which is partly modern and partly historical, so that the whole thing seems possible and contemporary, but is also bathed in an atmosphere of history and legend. And that is something which deepens and spreads throughout the three volumes of this extraordinary saga as we move out of the small, domestic, safe world of the Shire, where the hobbits live, and into this vast scene of Middle-earth with its mountains and monsters and wars. I think in this scene I'm very struck by how much is there in a nutshell, as it were, that is going to open up and expand into this vast narrative that lies ahead. And the moment of Bilbo's disappearance is really the moment that sets the whole magical thing in action.
That is Alan Hollinghurst. They have been wonderful. You can share yours as well, by the way. You can email today at bbc.co.uk. It's 25 past seven. Carthy's back with the sport.
Morning. Pretty grim outside, raining and windy on the way in this morning while listening to the Australian Open, where temperatures are around 42, 43 degrees now. Annabelle Croft is part of the Five Live team in Melbourne. Always elegant, graceful and cool, Annabelle. But give us an idea of what it's like just walking around the grounds today.
I certainly did not feel like that today, Carthy. It has been unbearably hot, brutal conditions. The sort of conditions that feel like when you walk outside, you've just entered into a sauna where you've got sort of hot air going up your nostrils and feels like someone is permanently blowing a hot hairdryer on your skin when you're walking around. So definitely not the kind of conditions that I would like to be doing anything physical or exerting myself. But it's been very, very difficult. But of course, they have been able to close the roof midway through the day today. So tennis continued and it was much nicer conditions for somebody like Zverev and Tien, who were on Rod Laver Arena, and of course for the spectators and fans as well.
Yeah, what are the main challenges for the players, just in general? I know the roof is on now, which makes a bit of a difference, but players that want to train and just get ready for matches as well as actually playing and competing.
Well, that's a very good point. In fact, as we are speaking, we've just had Alcaraz out on the Rod Laver Arena, just sort of warming up, you know, in the sort of conditions that he's probably going to be playing in today. But I think there wasn't a lot going on the outside courts. I know they did change the schedule earlier today for the juniors. They were on very, very early, so some of those would have been out. You know, it was still really, really hot early this morning before breakfast, but they haven't really had any play on the courts from lunchtime till about 6:30. Wheelchairs were all cancelled today. So I'm sure for players that were going to be playing outside this morning, they would have wanted to have played in those conditions. But I think to prepare for this kind of weather, it's all about their physical trainers, you know, getting as much hydration and water into them, as many electrolytes as possible. But to be honest, it's extraordinarily difficult conditions and very, very unusual.
And playing very well in those conditions. Arina Sabalenka, the world number one without the roof. She's won 4 Grand Slam titles. She defeated the talented American teenager Iva Jovic to reach the quarterfinals. What does Sabalenka do to get past the 18-year-old in straight sets too?
Well, she did so well, Carthy, because obviously there was enormous pressure. Nobody wants to lose to a youngster. And, you know, Jovic was somebody who qualified at Wimbledon last year. She's gone from 191 in the world at the beginning, or this time last year, to up at seeded 29 here at the Australian Open. She'd had some good results along the way. She's really made quite an announcement on the big stage in a Grand Slam here to even be able to face Sabalenka in the quarterfinals. But Sabalenka came out and stamped authority. She served really, really well. She was striking with authority from the back of the court, hitting lots of winners. And suddenly Jovic came back at her, started to pressure her. The crowd got behind her. It was starting to get quite shaky and interesting in that first set. But I have to be honest, Sabalenka is so brave. When she's facing adversity in matches or big pressure moments, she can often come up with the goods. And she served some aces, came up with some massive winners when it really, really mattered. And then she steamrolled through the second set and came off court saying that was some of the most flawless tennis that she'd played, you know, almost in her career. So I think she was pretty pleased to put aside the youngster, but actually has put herself in a great position into that semi-final.
Yep. Annabel Croft, stay cool if you can in Australia. Thank you very much for bringing us up to date. The world number 3, Alexander Zverev, is also through to the quarterfinals, and we've got Carlos Alcaraz and Coco Gauff coming up later. And England's men play the decisive third one-day international against Sri Lanka in Colombo. We'll be discussing that in the next hour.
Thank you, Garthy. On Thursday, John Wilson dives into the creative life of another leading artist.
Every week on This Cultural Life, I speak to some of the world's leading artists and creative people to uncover the moments that shape them. The new series includes comedian and actor Ricky Gervais.
I remember asking my mum when I was about 13, I said, "Why are my brothers and sisters so much older than me?" And my mum said, "Because you were a mistake." That made me laugh. I realised honesty was funny.
One of the all-time greats of photography, Annie Leibovitz.
If I could have a camera implanted in the middle of my forehead, I would.
And in the next episode, I'll be talking to the actor Jonathan Pryce.
When I see myself on screen, I don't recognise myself because I can't possibly be this old man that I'm seeing.
This Cultural Life with me, John Wilson. Thursday mornings at 11 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Some weather warnings around this morning to watch out for. Heavy rain basically pushing north and east today. Heavy hill snow in the north, and it'll be very windy as well, with gales again in the north and also in the west.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Nick Robinson. At half past 7, Caroline Nichols has a summary of the news.
Some federal immigration agents are expected to begin withdrawing from Minneapolis after the city's Democratic mayor held talks with President Trump. Jacob Frey said the president accepted that the present situation cannot continue. The move follows a public backlash over the fatal shooting of Alex Preti just weeks after another US citizen, Renee Good, was killed by immigration officers. Around 50 Labour MPs have written to the Prime Minister, calling on him to rethink the decision to block Andy Burnham from standing as an MP. Sir Keir Starmer has defended the move, saying allowing Mr Burnham to resign as the Mayor of Greater Manchester to contest the Gorton and Denton seat would have diverted resources from other key elections. The government has announced a cap on ground rents paid by leaseholders in England and Wales. The figure has been set at £250 a year. Labour's election manifesto pledged to tackle unregulated charges affecting around 5 million homes, most of them flats. Learner drivers in Northern Ireland will become the first in the UK to be issued with graduated driving licences from October. The scheme will introduce restrictions on carrying passengers at night in an effort to reduce the number of young drivers involved in serious and fatal crashes. In France, the National Assembly has backed plans to ban children under the age of 15 from using social media. President Macron wants France to follow Australia, which last month became the first country to introduce a similar restriction. The bill now moves to the Senate before returning to the Assembly for a final vote. Buildings across the UK will be illuminated this evening to mark Holocaust Memorial Day, which commemorates the 6 million people murdered by the Nazi regime more than 80 years ago. The King and Queen will host a reception for Holocaust survivors and their families. Organisers say that at a time of rising anti-Semitism, this is a moment to stand together.
Thank you, Caroline. It's 28 minutes to eight. An unprecedented legal case will take place in Los Angeles today. A 19-year-old woman suing some of the biggest social media brands like Meta and YouTube, who she says ruined her mental health by populating her feeds with damaging content through the algorithms that they created. There are thousands of other similar lawsuits around the world, but this is the first one to come to trial. The companies involved haven't said too much yet about what their defence will be based on, but they are expected to make those arguments robustly in court. YouTube, for example, says the allegations are simply not true. But before we dig a little deeper into that debate, let's go back, because I spoke earlier to Chris Messina, who was one of the first users of what was then Twitter and the creator of the hashtag, that was his idea, about the vision of those early days and how things changed.
When we were starting to build social networks, the idea was to connect with friends, was to make it easier for us to go out and have a good time and share what we were doing. And social media platforms figured out different techniques and approaches to make that process much more efficient. And I think we're living through what happens when social connection becomes hyper-optimized in the context of a commercial and capitalist system.
I think it's really easy to forget, actually, nowadays, when we look at what social media is and what it has become, what those early intentions were. When you came up with the idea of the hashtag, what were you trying to achieve with that back then?
This is 2006, and Twitter happened to be this new network. We could send a text message to Twitter, and then Twitter would send that message out to all of our friends who were following us. And the hashtag was designed as a way to connect with people that weren't necessarily already following you. I mean, it's so, in some ways, like trite and innocent in a way, looking back, but the intention was quite pure. You know, the intention was to connect with other people who were sharing similar interests and were also happening to use the internet.
Did you foresee back then, did you have any idea that it would become so hyper commercialized that it would end up being about money and about business to the extent where actually it would become dangerous to some people?
You know, I think there's this really difficult aspect of this story to relate to, which is that those of us who are there early building these things oftentimes got so much rejection and skepticism. You know, why do I need this? Why do I want this? Like, why do people want to know what I had for breakfast? And so those of us who were building these things and saw this great potential, I think felt that if we made these products easier to use, more interesting, more engaging, more interactive, that they would address some of those complaints and challenges that people put towards us. And as these platforms became more effective at keeping and holding attention, the commercial interests, I think, ran roughshod over a lot of the breaks or the friction points that kind of allowed us to, you know, take a step back and return to the real world. And so now, you know, when a young person joins social media, they're living in a world that is hyper-engaging. The friction points have all been removed. And that can, I'm sure, feel extremely overwhelming. And there's no context. There's no history that sort of explains, look, you know, in the last 20 years, we've sort of embarked on this massive experiment to figure out how to help us to communicate to each other.
And now we find ourselves in a position where there is a court case where somebody is actively saying, this technology has ruined my life. Is there basis in that?
You know, I don't know all the particulars of that person's experience. And, you know, I feel for that person feeling that this might be the case. What I can tell you is that technology is very much an amplifier. And humans have been finding ways to shame and debase and create power games for as long as humans have really been around. And so I absolutely can see how those behaviors are being amplified in these products. But whether or not the platforms themselves are liable for that, I think is a big open question, and I'm not convinced that that's the case.
That's Chris Messina, who invented the hashtag. He was one of the first users of what was called Twitter back in the early days. Well, I spoke earlier to Matthew Bergman, who is founding attorney of the Social Media Victims Law Centre. He is one of the lawyers representing the plaintiff in this case.
The social media companies have intentionally designed their platforms to be addictive to young people. They show kids not what they want to see, but what they can't look away from. And through their engagement, their susceptibility to the advertising that these companies make billions of dollars every year from.
Well, let me tell you what they say. A YouTube spokesperson said, providing young people with safer, healthier experiences being core to our work. We build services and policies to provide young people with age-appropriate experiences and parents with robust controls. The allegations in these complaints are simply not true. Meta, which owns Facebook and Instagram, agrees. It says, we strongly disagree with the allegations. We're confident the evidence will show our long-standing commitment to supporting young people. We've also approached TikTok for comment. They were part of this case, but Matthew Bergman, the attorney, told us that they had settled actually before it began today. Let's talk to Bruce Daisley, who is a former vice president at Twitter, former YouTube UK lead. Morning, Bruce.
Good morning.
This is a really, it's not a new debate, and it's quite a thorny one. Whose responsibility is it? Because in this case, they're saying it's the algorithms, it's the development of the algorithms that have caused the problem, and that lies at the feet of the social media companies.
Yeah, almost certainly, you know, there's a degree of truth in that. The way that social media apps work is that generally someone will spend time not necessarily trying to make the app more addictive, but to try and reduce the friction points. So they will identify that people maybe leave the app when they click on a link, or they leave the app when content. Sometimes, for example, Instagram, I think in the past has found that when there are arguments or when there's toxicity, people leave the app. And so they will identify those things that tend to cause people to leave, and they will try and optimize, they will try and build an algorithm to get around that. In addition, the big change, I think, for 2026 is that most of these social media apps now don't use a single one-size-fits-all algorithm. They use some degree of machine learning, artificial intelligence of sorts, specific to every user. So that means that if the product was a degree addictive in the past, it's very likely to second guess you and be even more addictive today.
Do you think it's the sort of thing that should be taken out of the hands of companies, and there should be stronger legislation in place, as there is? I mean, we talked earlier about things like cigarettes, we talked about alcohol, and the fact that actually society creates its own rules around those to keep children away from them. Is that what we need?
For adults, my instinct personally is no. It's worth making a sort of an equivalence that while young people are spending maybe a few hours a day on different social apps, they spend about an hour and a half a day under 24s on TikTok. Instagram, they spend about an hour a day. But if you could equate that to traditional broadcast and traditional media, well, it was not uncommon for people to spend 3 hours a night watching TV.
And so it doesn't have that same interactivity, though, does it? And stuff like that has, you know, it's been curated, it's been chosen. It's a different sort of world to plunge into social media.
It is. But there's a degree of subjectivity there, in the same way that sometimes we might look across scornfully at someone being on their phone, but they might be reading the same news content that if they were reading it in a printed paper form, we'd consider that was quite benign. And some of it is about subjective interpretation. Sometimes we bring a lens to deciding what's more or less beneficial. I've chatted to teachers, and my instinct, of course, like everyone, was to think, you know, young people should be watching much less content. And teachers have said to me, oh, that things like YouTube or TikTok, by providing video content for a wider audience, it fulfills some of the role that maybe going home and watching a TV comedy provided to sort of lubricate playground chat the next day. Yeah. So we can bring our own lens to decide if something is benign or evil, I think.
If we do get into a world where court cases become the norm and companies perhaps find themselves having to pay out substantial amounts of damages, do you think, and I realise we're looking well into the future here, there'll come a point where they think this business model is not working anymore for us the way we wanted it to?
No, I don't think so. It's incredibly lucrative for the platforms. I think some degree of review is very healthy. You know, the as we've seen, France is likely to follow Australia with a social media ban. And look, it's really interesting to articulate the nuance of that. You'd have thought Ian Russell, the father of Molly Russell, would have said, oh, he'd be in favour of a ban. His daughter became victim of these social platforms. And actually, his instinct is, no, that's not the right thing. That he creates a cliff edge at the age of 16. It throws people into an environment they're not familiar with it. Yeah. And I think that demonstrates that we must be careful of simple answers to complicated problems. Yeah. My own instinct is I suspect a degree more review is a much healthier thing.
Okay.
You know, if Ofcom actually became quite active and considered sort of the consequence of some of the decisions that are happening, then I think these things are healthy. We need to sort of hold these companies to account.
Okay, perhaps on the brink of that. We'll wait and see. Bruce Daisley, thanks for your thoughts.
18 minutes to eight now. What has just happened in Iran under the cover of the digital darkness imposed by the country's theocratic regime? And what happened to Donald Trump's promise to protesters that help was on its way? There are many different estimates of the death toll, but Time magazine quotes two senior officials in Iran's Ministry of Health who say that more than 30,000 people were killed in just 2 days. If that figure is right, and of course it is a big if, the magazine points out, this would only be matched by the scale of massacres carried out by Nazi death squads. Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, has admitted that several thousands have been killed, blaming protesters, who he describes as foot soldiers of the United States. Yesterday on the programme, we heard from Professor Payam Akhavan, an Iranian-born Canadian international lawyer and human rights advocate, who spoke at the UN recently about the need for what he calls a Nuremberg moment, referring to the international criminal trials of Nazi leaders following World War II.
Even by conservative estimates, and even against the blood-stained record of the Islamic Republic, which is well documented by the UN, this is by far the worst, most unprecedented mass killing. Just on January 23rd, when I was speaking before the Human Rights Council, we received a report from a network of physicians within Iran that, based on clinical and forensic records and statistical extrapolation, have arrived at a conservative estimate of at least 33,000 people having been killed within a span of a few days. And in my opinion, this begins to resemble not just a crime against humanity, as it is defined in the statute of the International Criminal Court, but it begins to resemble specifically the crime of extermination.
A huge US task force is now assembling in the Middle East. Is that the help from Trump about to come? And if so, in what form would it be? Watching carefully for us, Shashank Joshi, defence editor of The Economist, who joins us. Morning to you, Shashank. Before we talk about the military build-up, help us with this death toll. It is very, very difficult for Western journalists to know, indeed even to assess, the claims that are coming out of Iran, isn't it?
It's incredibly hard. We have, of course, estimates from human rights monitors based outside the country. Those numbers have been fairly small. Numbers coming out of the country are much bigger as pictures, videos emerge. But look, that figure you mentioned is sizable. But my own colleagues at The Economist have been talking to people in Tehran, including officials. And what they have reported this week is that they think the death toll may approach 20,000. So that isn't dissimilar to the figure you mentioned. Clearly a huge figure. It brings to mind, of course, things like the Tiananmen Square massacre. But when you adjust for Iran's population, you realize it's a monstrously large figure. And I think it tells you the scale of violence perpetrated in just a few short days.
That then is the context for the decisions that Donald Trump has to take now. How big is the task force that is steamed towards the Middle East?
Well, it's important to know it's not just the task force steaming. Of course, you have the USS Abraham Lincoln. This is an aircraft carrier. It's a Nimitz class. And it's not just the carrier. It's the strike group around it. The carrier has lots of planes, of course, that can carry lots of ordnance and strike Iran. But there's the destroyers around it that also carry missiles and can launch those. It's the air defenses around it that can protect Gulf countries from prospective retaliation, which was a very important factor, I think, in staying Donald Trump's hands a couple of weeks ago when he decided not to strike. And then you also have a lot of stuff coming from other places. You've got things like F-15E jets coming from the United Kingdom going to the Middle East. And those are the planes that shot down Iranian drones over Israel about 2 years ago, about 18 months ago. You've got cargo planes, refueling tankers, electronic warfare aircraft. So if Donald Trump may not have made his mind, but what's in the region today within reach of Iran is now significantly greater than it was just a couple of weeks ago when he said help was coming and then, of course, backed down by saying the killing had stopped.
Don't mistake delay, you seem to be saying, for inaction. In other words, Benjamin Netanyahu, we know the Israeli prime minister, urged Donald Trump not to act, presumably because they didn't feel that Israel was ready to protect itself from the barrage of Iranian missiles that might follow any attack.
I think that's right. And of course, what we saw 2 years ago was major Iranian drone attacks that America was able to defend against. What we saw last summer when America struck was a fairly limited Iranian retaliation. It was against Al Udeid Air Base, America's forward air base in Qatar. But it was a very choreographed and limited attack by Iran. What Iran's signaling this time, the regime feels much more under threat. This is going to be a strike potentially not just against nuclear sites or missile sites, but against political leadership. They're saying we'll treat this as an all-out conflict and implying they will strike Gulf Arab military bases in the region. Those are much closer to Iran. They have many more missiles capable of hitting those than they do hitting Israel. And so there's a lot more air defense that is needed as a result.
You can't know. Nobody can know, Shashank. But briefly, if you would, what do you think is the chance of a US-Israeli military strike on Iran?
I still think it is likely in the coming days, but Donald Trump has given an interview yesterday where he said he hasn't made his mind up. He's open to a deal. But of course, the deal he wants and is proposing is for Iran to give up its nuclear enrichment entirely, give up its long-range missiles, end its support for armed groups in the region. All of that will be a very, very bitter pill, even for a weakened regime to swallow. And therefore, I still feel we are on a path to a large, substantial US military strike.
Shashank Joshi of The Economist, thanks for joining us.
It's 12 minutes to 8 now, time for Thought for the Day. And the speaker this morning is the Chief Rabbi, Sarah from Mervis.
Good morning. Harry Ulmer, MBE, once said, "For decades I have shared my story. I tell young people about the 6 million men, women and children who were murdered because they were Jewish. I tell them about my family, my friends and my community. So few of us survived the Holocaust and made it to safety in Britain. But who will tell my story in the future? Who will remember the Jews of Europe and what happened when hatred took over?" Harry passed away 12 days ago. A survivor of multiple concentration camps, he came to England after the war. Here he recuperated in Windermere, along with 300 other young people, known as the Boys. In 1954, he was conscripted into the British Army and served in Germany. He went on to have a family and a long career in dentistry. Today is Holocaust Memorial Day, when we recognize that, like so many other Holocaust survivors, Harry's deepest concern was the possibility that the world might forget the indescribable depths of inhumanity they and their families suffered. That is why, for decades, survivors like Harry have stood in classrooms and community halls, providing living testimony. But the number of Holocaust survivors is rapidly diminishing. Soon, there will be none left to correct distortion or challenge denial with a simple but powerful declaration, "I was there." But that's not all. Many of the remaining survivors are distraught to see that anti-Semitism is once again rising sharply. And this begs the question, of what value is memory if it does not move us to action in the present? In the Bible, the term zachor, meaning remember, never means passive recall. For example, in the Ten Commandments, the instruction, "Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy," calls us to actively participate in inspirational Sabbath activities at home and in synagogue. Jewish memory is not something we think, but something we do. The granting of royal assent last week to the Holocaust Memorial Bill was a significant moment for our country, reflecting a clear national commitment to remembrance and to ensuring that the lessons of the Holocaust are not forgotten. This memorial and learning center will inspire us to actively confront anti-Semitism, hatred, and indifference wherever they appear. The lessons of the Holocaust call upon us to proactively inspire future generations to fight apathy and injustice and to stand up against prejudice and evil. Harry Ulmer said, "As a Holocaust survivor, I am asking you to share my story today and when I am gone. Now, it's our turn to do so."
That was Thought for the Day with the Chief Rabbi, Sir Ephraim Mervis. It is 9 minutes to eight.
How can we keep people working rather than signing more and more off sick? That was the exam question set for Charlie Mayfield, former chair of John Lewis and his Keep Britain Working review. Ever since his report was published, he's been working with companies to implement his central idea that they, not the government alone, need to play a role in keeping their employees healthy. Some of the companies he's working with are paying for their employees to have private medical treatment. They're not forced to be off work as they wait for NHS care. That, of course, raises its own problems, as Dr. Sam Phillips, who is head of health and wellbeing for Transport for London, now explains.
So we have employees who are unable to work in their role if they can't meet the medical standards. So an example of that could be a tube operator who develops cataracts and they then don't meet the eyesight standards to be able to work. But at the moment, they may be on an NHS waiting list of 6 to 12 months to get their surgery. So the sort of position we take is in those kind of scenarios, we will fund that person's treatment because it makes good sense to help them get back to work more quickly. The trouble with that is that is then is a benefit in kind, which the employee or the employer has to pay tax on. So, you know, one thing that we're hoping will come out of this Keep Britain Working initiative will be perhaps be that the government will look at initiatives to help support employers who fund treatment to get people back to work more quickly.
Well, listening to that is Sir Charlie Mayfield, the chair of that Keep Britain Working review. Morning to you, Sir Charlie.
Good morning, Nick.
That is an example, isn't it, of where you've been saying to businesses, you've got to get more involved, and they're coming back to you and say, yeah, but we need help.
Yeah, of course they do. But I think we're basically saying, look, we've got to get employers on the pitch. Employers can make a huge difference to handling ill health and disability in the workplace. Employees have a role to play, providers have a role to play, and the government has a role to play. And what we're basically figuring out is how to put all that together so that the whole system works much, much better.
It'd be quite controversial for government to give tax breaks to people using private healthcare. Are you at all tempted by the idea?
Well, that's we're not really focusing on that specifically at the moment. I mean, I think where we start from is that currently we have a lot of fear. So basically, when people get ill in work, they're generally fearful of telling their employer about it. And the employers are often fearful of talking to people about it. And so you create distance. And if you have distance when people are unwell, it really does not help to get this thing better. Add to that problems with things like fit notes and the whole system whereby when we do treat people, we tend to sign them off work. And again, you exacerbate that distance. So we're starting sort of way up the chain where we're saying, look, we've got to sort the system out. We've got to get people playing in the right places on the pitch, doing the right thing. And if we can do that, we can make a huge difference to the outcomes and affect things like welfare.
And you've got some companies that you call vanguard companies who are trying this out with you. Has it led to quite a big change in the way they see things and the way they do things?
Well, first of all, I think the point to make is the level of engagement we're seeing from employers, but also from the mayoral authorities. I'm in Manchester today. I was at dinner last night with 10 of the mayors, and I've got a meeting with some of them today. And the level of engagement we're seeing from employers, from mayors, from providers is really extraordinary. There's such a lot of appetite to try and get involved in solving this problem. When we published the report, we had 60 employers as vanguards. We're now we've doubled that, and we've doubled the number of mayors who said they want to get involved. And frankly, it's just growing all the time.
And when you read the latest statistics, which are stark, aren't they, about the number of jobless graduates, 700,000 now, is there a link between these people who are not in work at all and the fact that there are people who are in work but sick?
I think there's the real point is that clearly you want to get more people into work. So that's a sort of slightly different issue. And I think, of course, with the economic cycles and things going on, you're going to have various opportunities for people to get in and out of work. What we're focused on is, though, is keeping people in work, because what we know is that if somebody falls out of work, let's say they get signed off sick for a month, and then it becomes 2 months, and then three, then six, after a year, the chances of that person ever returning to work fall dramatically. So what we have to do is get a lot better at tackling those situations much earlier. And we need employers playing a role in that and various others. And actually, we're very confident that there's a lot we can do to fix it.
Now, you've done the report. You're working with these companies. How soon do you go back to government again and say, right, we've tried some of these ideas out. This is what we need you to do.
Well, when we published, we said that we needed a 3-year, what we call the vanguard phase. Actually, since we published, I've decided that we have to break the back of most of what we need to do within a year. And so we are motoring really fast. And we are about to start 5 employer sprints imminently. They'll start at the beginning of next month, including one led by Sarah Jackson from EDF, who you had on the programme earlier.
Employer sprints means they implement this all quickly.
Well, no, what we do is we work with employers to figure out the mechanics of how do we do this really well. Because, again, what you've heard from both Sam from TfL, she's also going to be involved with one of our sprints, and Sarah, is you've got to get clarity for the employers. They've got to tell people what they actually need to do. We've got to figure out how we support them to do that really well. And then what we'll be saying to government is, right, and what government has to do is to create the right set of incentives that encourage many, many employers to get on board.
So, Charlie Mayfield, thanks for keeping us up to date with what is going on. Very important project, that Keep Britain Working, to keep people in the workforce rather than off sick.
Tell us, sweetheart, who was it? Who did this to you?
Arrived late to Ambridge. Did you know that most smart speakers can start the program again? Just say, ask BBC Sounds to restart and listen from the beginning.
Here, are you ready? Grandma and Grandpa are waiting for us. We need to leave.
Try it for yourself. Just say, ask BBC Sounds to restart.
Let's get the weather now. Here's Helen Willetts.
Anna, thanks very much indeed. So we have got some really miserable weather out there, courtesy of Storm Chandra. So very quick roundup. We've got the amber warning from the Met Office, the southwest of England, running out in an hour. That's for the heavy rain. We have seen over 100 millimetres of rain. The ground is saturated. There's a severe flood warning down here too. More details on the website. I can't read it all out now. We've got over 100 flood warnings, you see, for England at the moment, and numerous are now sort of developing across Wales and Scotland as well. So it's one massive rain pushing its way northwards, clearing from the southwest now, followed by showers, heavy and thundery with squally winds. Winds is another element. We've got an amber warning for the eastern side of Northern Ireland for those winds, gusting up to 75 miles an hour, so potentially with strong winds across the country, we could see some further damage coming through. It looks pretty nasty indeed. So England and Wales, it's wet, it's windy. We've got snow over the hills, snow over the Pennines. It's already closed parts of the A66. Even though it brightens up, we'll see heavy showers and thunderstorms with squally winds coming in. And those winds could continue to cause problems because, of course, recent storms have started to dislodge trees and weaken structures. Temperatures fairly academic, 7 to 10 degrees Celsius today, and those strong winds across all parts. I mentioned the amber wind warning for the Met Office for Northern Ireland. It's windy across the whole of the UK, but for Northern Ireland, those gusts 75 miles an hour have caused issues at Belfast Airport, for example. It's wet for the next few hours, but here too it brightens with showers later. Temperatures around about 7 or 8 degrees. As well as the snow that we're seeing over the hills of Northern England, it's a similar story now for Scotland. The southern uplands, central and highland Scotland, as the rain continues its journey further north through the day today, because northern Scotland mostly dry at the moment, but some snow, significant snow on the hills, blowing around in these strong winds. So temperatures around about 3 or 4 at best here, and heavy rain to boot.
Thank you, Helen. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Anna Foster. Good morning, it's 8 o'clock on Tuesday, the 27th of January. The headlines this morning: a prominent commander of Donald Trump's immigration crackdown is set to leave Minneapolis after the city's mayor said the current situation cannot continue. About 50 Labour MPs have urged the party leadership to rethink the decision to stop Andy Burnham standing in a parliamentary by-election next month. And a major study has found that brain changes during the menopause are similar to those seen in Alzheimer's.
Coming up in the next hour, a friend or a threat? How will Keir Starmer balance the economy with security this week as he becomes the first Prime Minister to visit China since Theresa May back in 2018? And Holst's famous planet suite has been reimagined.
Earth awakens. Water braids.
shimmers. Droplets seek droplets, weave streams to rivers, rivers.
The nature writer Robert McFarlane tells us about a brand new movement that's been composed to represent planet Earth. That's all after the BBC News read for us this morning by Caroline Nichols.
The Democratic mayor of Minneapolis has said that some federal agents will begin leaving the city after he held a call with President Trump. There's been a growing backlash to the killing of Alex Pretty on Saturday, weeks after Renee Good, another US citizen, was shot dead by immigration officers. Those leaving are expected to include the controversial Border Patrol chief, Gregory Bovino. But the Trump administration insists he's not been relieved of his duties. Our correspondent, Tom Bateman, sent this report from Minneapolis.
Agents in gas masks fired irritants towards protesters who'd gathered for what they called a Goodbye Bovino noise demo, banging drums and clattering pieces of wood outside the hotel where they said the Border Patrol commander was staying. His expected departure from Minneapolis, along with some of his agents, marks a partial victory for the demonstrators and for Minnesota's Democratic leadership. The White House appears to be trying to deflect the anger over the killing of Alex Pretty by moving Mr. Bovino, who had alleged the 37-year-old nurse intended to carry out a massacre before he was shot dead, despite there being no evidence for that claim. In a shift of tone, Mr. Trump said he had good phone calls with the Democrat leadership of the city and state. The mayor of Minneapolis, Jacob Frey's statement on the call said Mr. Trump had agreed that the present situation could not continue. But this is not a retreat by the Trump administration from its deportation drive overall. With Mr. Trump sending another envoy to Minneapolis, his border czar, Tom Homan, while his press secretary continued to blame Democrats for what she called deliberate and hostile resistance.
Around 50 Labour MPs have written to the Prime Minister and the chair of the party's National Executive Committee, calling on them to rethink the decision to block Andy Burnham from standing to be an MP. Sir Keir Starmer has defended the decision, claiming that allowing Mr. Burnham to stand down as the Mayor of Greater Manchester in order to contest the Gorton and Denton by-election would have diverted resources away from other crucial elections. Here's our political correspondent, Jack Fenwick.
The MPs who signed the letter said the decision to block Andy Burnham caused a huge amount of anxiety and anger among colleagues. The number of names suggests those feelings go beyond the so-called usual suspects. They warned the Prime Minister that the decision was a real gift to Nigel Farage and said losing the upcoming by-election would be unimaginable. Labour won the seat in 2024 with a 13,000 majority, but Reform and the Greens are both expected to be much more competitive this time round. It had widely been expected that if Andy Burnham won the seat, it could open the door to him challenging Sir Keir for the Labour leadership later this year. The former Labour Cabinet Minister, Baroness Harman, told BBC Newsnight that her parliamentary colleagues should move on and focus on winning the by-election instead of discussing the decision to block Mr. Burnham.
Sir Keir Starmer will travel to China today, the first visit there by a British Prime Minister in 8 years. The trip comes a week after the government granted Beijing permission to build the biggest embassy in Europe in London. A number 10 source says ministers are determined to pursue a hard-headed, grown-up approach to the UK's relationship with China. The government is to cap ground rents at £250 a year for leaseholders in England and Wales as part of a raft of proposed changes to current laws. Other measures include banning new leasehold flats and giving existing leaseholders the right to switch to commonhold to give them greater control over their properties. The Residential Freehold Association said a significant number of professional freeholders would be put at risk of immediate solvency. The legal expert, Daniel Stern, told this programme there were bound to be challenges.
From a legal perspective, this is going to be retrofitting it to existing contracts. What they're going to have to say is that there's legislation that they're going to bring through. I think the government has predicted the legal challenge already. They initially came out and said it would be zero. They're hoping to strike a halfway balance here to keep the pension funds happy and the leaseholders happy. But I have no doubt that there will still be legal challenge to this.
Northern Ireland is to become the first area of the UK to bring in graduated driver licensing. New drivers who pass their test there will have restrictions on night-time driving and the carrying of passengers. Pat Delaney is from the Driver and Vehicle Agency.
The Road Traffic Order of Northern Ireland has provisions for penalties if those restrictions are not adhered to. So there's 3 penalty points or a fine of up to £1,000. But what we would hope particularly for new young drivers, is that parents and guardians will be very supportive of graduated driver licensing and will help to police that.
A woman who reported being raped by her former partner, a serving police officer, has spoken to the BBC about the trauma of being prosecuted for lying about the allegation. BBC File on 4 Investigates has heard that it was discovered at the trial that police failed to properly analyse an audio recording of the alleged assault. Rebecca Woods has more.
In 2020, Ruth, whose name we have changed to protect her identity, reported that her ex-partner, a police officer, had raped her. He wasn't charged with any crime, and instead, Ruth was prosecuted for perverting the course of justice.
I thought that they really, truly, honestly were supporting me, and then it very quickly turned. They said I was a scorned woman, he didn't want me, so therefore I cried rape.
Her trial heard a secret recording he'd made of the sexual act. He claimed it proved Ruth was lying, but in the audio, she could be heard withdrawing her consent. Ruth was cleared by a jury. Her ex-partner remains an officer with West Midlands Police, but is currently suspended on full pay while awaiting a misconduct hearing. He has not responded to a request for comment. Warwickshire Police, who carried out the rape investigation, said it takes all reports of rape extremely seriously, and it has since invested more resources into rape cases.
You can hear more on File on 4 Investigates on BBC Sounds. A large UK study has found that the menopause can cause a loss of grey matter in women's brains, affecting memory and emotions, similar to that seen in Alzheimer's. It's been published in the journal Psychological Medicine. The changes it found might partly explain why women are generally at greater risk of dementia than men. Here's our health reporter, Michelle Roberts.
The study involved nearly 125,000 UK women, of whom 11,000 had MRI brain scans, and the results suggest the menopause takes a toll on the brain, even with hormone replacement therapy treatment. The regions affected are similar to those impacted in Alzheimer's disease. The researchers from Cambridge University say the findings might help shed light on why dementia is twice as common in women than in men. But more studies are needed to better understand how menopause impacts the brain and what, if anything, could be done about it.
Events are taking place around the world to mark Holocaust Memorial Day, which remembers the 6 million, mostly Jewish people, who were murdered by the Nazis more than 80 years ago. The theme of this year's event is Bridging Generations. Here's our religion editor, Aline McBull.
Every year on this date, the anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz, there are events around the world to remember the 6 million Jews killed in the Holocaust. This year, the King and Queen will host a reception for Holocaust survivors and their families, and later, political and faith leaders will join together in remembrance, and landmarks around the country will be lit up in purple. The theme of events this year is a call to action for younger generations to pass on the lessons of the Holocaust, given that with each passing year, there are fewer opportunities to hear firsthand from survivors. The organisers of UK commemorations also say that at a time of rising prejudice and anti-Semitism, it's an opportunity to stand united in empathy and understanding.
Storm Chandra is causing travel disruption with heavy rain affecting southwest England. There are closures in Devon, Dorset and Somerset, and roads have flooded in South Wales. Strong winds are hitting Northern Ireland's east coast. The BBC is launching its biggest music education initiative in a decade this morning. It's designed to encourage more teenagers to sing together. Our education reporter, Kate McGough, has more.
Singing together like this happens less often when students reach their teenage years. Research by the survey tool TeacherTap found that a third of state secondary schools in England don't have a choir. To tackle this decline, the BBC has begun a nationwide music education initiative called BBC Get Singing. The aim is to get more 11 to 14-year-olds across the UK singing together, both in and out of school. It's a three-year project with free arrangements of songs available through BBC Bitesize, alongside a range of resources to help teachers and students sing more. The Grammy Award-winning artist, Jacob Collier, is ambassador for the scheme and says the act of singing together can combat social isolation in young people.
Kate McGough reporting.
Thank you, Caroline. It's 10 minutes past eight. For years, we've blown hot and cold. We had the Golden Age, which flipped to an ice age. We reject that binary choice. Those were the words last month of Sir Keir Starmer on China. And today he will become the first British Prime Minister since Theresa May in 2018 to travel to Beijing. It is a pivotal moment for the relationship between the two countries. The approval just last week of a huge new Chinese super embassy in London will help to warm what might have been a frosty conversation on that particular topic. There is pressure to raise the case of British citizen Jimmy Lai, jailed in Hong Kong for the crime of publishing pro-democracy material. There's also that strong undercurrent of shifting geopolitical relationships. The strain between the US and Europe in recent weeks over President Trump's pursuit of Greenland is a case in point on that. And what could ultimately turn into a rewriting of the global order that has endured for decades. So let's discuss that and more with Sir Jeremy Hunt, former Foreign Secretary and Chancellor, who visited China to meet Foreign Minister Wang Yi back in 2018. And Lord Sedwill is with us as well, former Cabinet Secretary, head of the Civil Service under Theresa May and Boris Johnson, and also the UK's former National Security Advisor as well. Good morning, both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I think a good place to start, before we deal with some of those bigger geopolitical questions, is just the differences. So, Jeremy Hunt, you, as we said, you went to China, you had some of those conversations. It is a society that operates so differently to ours.
Absolutely. And the first thing to say is I think Keir Starmer is right to go to China and to talk to Xi Jinping. China's the second most powerful country in the world. And Xi Jinping is probably the most powerful world leader. But it would be a big mistake to try and go back to the kind of golden era discussions of 15 years ago, because China is very different and the world is very different. Back in 2010, it was before Xi Jinping, China was liberalizing politically. Since then, it's built on some measures the largest military in the world. It's trying to dominate the South China Sea. It's removed freedoms in Hong Kong. And it wants to develop an unassailable position in technology as a way of economically dominating the world. And so I think Keir Starmer needs to be very cautious in that context.
I'm curious about how he will approach those conversations. How did you?
Well, I think it is important to listen. But in my experience, it's very hard to get personal chemistry with your interlocutor in China, because the meetings tend to be very formal. You speak through a translator. There are lots of people present. You could have a banquet with, you know, 30 people sitting around a table, but only one conversation between the two leaders happening. So it's very difficult to develop the kind of rapport and trust that you would normally be able to do when you go and visit a country. But I think it is important to do it, but it's important to be clear-eyed that the main purpose from Beijing's point of view will to be as friendly as they possibly can in order to hasten the breakup of an already fragile Atlantic alliance, particularly after last week. Their interest in us is not so much economic, it is geostrategic. It is the fact that we are America's closest security partner. And if they can prise apart that relationship, then it will have been a good visit from their perspective.
I want to talk a bit more about security, but actually I'm curious. We mentioned some of the issues which the Prime Minister is under pressure to raise, and human rights is often one of them. Was that something that you did when you went? Do you have a conversation about human rights?
I always did, because I took the view that Chinese people themselves can't raise those issues. And so if you're in a position to be able to raise them with very senior people, then you absolutely should. But there is a choice between
Was it awkward?
It was incredibly awkward. And quite often it would spoil the whole tone of the meeting. If you raise them in any serious way, you can raise them in a perfunctory way so that you can tick a box and say, you know, I talked about Jimmy Lai, I raised the issue. And both sides know that, you know, you want to be able to say that afterwards. But if you actually try and discuss why it is that they are imprisoning an innocent British man, as they're doing in the case of Jimmy Lai, then it becomes very difficult. China doesn't think we have any right whatsoever to raise those issues. So it is a diplomatic tightrope. I very much hope Keir Starmer does raise that issue in particular, because I think it is really important. But it has to be done in a very careful way.
Lord Sedwill, security, as we were saying, is a huge part of this. And actually looking at what the Chinese Foreign Ministry has released in the last few hours. They're talking about the beneficial relationship when it comes to things like global peace, stability, development for China and the UK to maintain communication and strengthen cooperation. But obviously things like security and what well, the sort of threat that China may or may not pose to the UK is very much under the surface, not spoken about here.
Well, it needs to be spoken about. Jeremy Hunt is absolutely right. He was talking about a particular human rights case, but exactly the same approach applies to security. I went to China, including actually during that 2018 visit when I was National Security Advisor, but I'd been before when I was running the Home Office, and we had a pretty tough dialogue with their internal security people. Then you have to raise these issues. You have to raise all of the issues, security, human rights, and so on. You do so, as Jeremy Hunt said, in a way that is careful, respectful, but you still have to be really clear about it. Diplomacy is not about talking to our friends. It is about talking to countries with whom we have at least a partially adversarial relationship, as we do with China. And I certainly found in dealing with the Chinese, I raised a range of very difficult issues with them. I certainly found if I did so, then they understood that that was the case. And I made sure it wasn't just a perfunctory issue. I raised cyber attacks, this kind of thing, and made clear to them if they didn't address these things through private dialogue, then we would have to go public and that would have consequences for the wider relationship.
We talked about the difference in society and the difference in culture. For China, Lord Sedwill, is security about, and I think I know what you're going to say to this, but is security about, you know, maintaining the cordiality of a relationship, something like we've seen with the US, for example? Or is it about always holding at arm's length and always keeping things back and operating very much that it's about you and you alone?
For them, security is about the Communist Party. So it's about Xi Jinping's control of the Communist Party, the Communist Party's control of China, China's dominance of its region, and then extending out beyond that, as you were saying earlier, Anna, through their relationships elsewhere and their efforts to dominate some of the new tech sectors and so on. So security is always uppermost in their mind. They see economic security and national security as wholly entwined. They're right about that. And we need to be equally clear-eyed in our approach to them. There, of course, it's an important relationship, as Jeremy Hunt said. We can't address many of the world's issues without China at the table. There are economic benefits which every country wants to secure, including, by the way, the United States. Donald Trump will be in China before long, and I'm sure we'll be seeking an eye-catching headline trade deal when he's there. So all of those things have to be in play, and one has to manage the whole range of what is a complex relationship.
Mm. Let's talk a little about the shift in global order as well. I was struck again by that statement from the Chinese Foreign Ministry earlier on, the last line of which talks about the sound and stable development of China-UK relations contributing actively and responsibly to global peace, security and stability, which looks a little like a message to the United States and the events of recent weeks. But Sir Jeremy Hunt, if we look at the report that Chatham House released last year, talking about what China is moving towards, this potential position of global economic and technological leadership comparable to the UK in the 19th century or the US in the 20th century, but it being a very different kind of country, a very different kind of state, as Lord Sedwill was saying, what sort of implications does that have for us all?
Well, it has very serious implications because we have to be totally clear-sighted about the fact that their values are different and they don't believe in open societies in the way that is fundamental to our own values. So they are thinking very strategically and very long-term in a way that sometimes we find hard about how to secure a position of global leadership. And they're looking to exploit the chaos of last week in Davos, because they've always thought that one of the big advantages the United States has that they don't have is a very close network of allies. And they can see the fractures in NATO from last week. And they'll be wondering if this is a moment to finally prise apart the Atlantic Alliance. And I think from Keir Starmer's point of view, I mean, obviously his priority is to try and show that he's doing something to help growth in the UK and help us get out of the economic doldrums. But the difficulty is that, you know, the kind of scraps that you might get from a Chinese trade deal will be tiny compared to the impact of the US economy. And, you know, we can see that Donald Trump has just slapped or threatened huge tariffs on Canada as a result of its trade deal with China. And, you know, the tech deal that we're supposed to be having with the US, but hasn't yet been finalized, that alone is worth far more than any Chinese trade deal. So there is a real diplomatic tightrope that Keir Starmer has to walk here. There will be some benefits, of course, from more trade with China, but there's also a huge amount of risk.
Lord Sedwell, do the people who are making those decisions need to think in the not too near future about choices, about maybe rewriting or reordering some of those relationships which we've relied on for so many years?
I wouldn't put it quite that starkly. I mean, it is the case, as Jeremy Hunt has just said, that Keir Starmer goes to China as the principal ally of the United States. And therefore, and what we mustn't do is over-interpret what Mark Carney was saying last week in Davos to suggest somehow or other that countries like the UK or Canada are going to find a point that is equidistant between the United States and China. That is simply not realistic and completely undesirable for us. We are the United States' closest ally. They are our biggest economic partner. And we must always double down on that relationship. But if it comes to a choice, that will be the choice that we make. But like the United States themselves, we want to have a productive economic relationship with China. There are a whole range of other issues, from climate change to global security issues, Security Council issues, on which we do need to have a dialogue with China. As I said, diplomacy is about talking to countries that are at least partially adversarial as well as talking to our friends. And we need to be able to do both. But if it comes to a choice, the choice is clear.
Lord Sedwell, Sir Jeremy Hunt, thank you for joining us.
It's now 8:22. Hulse, the planets include, as you all know, Mars, Venus, Mercury, seven planets in all, but not Earth. A brand new movement was composed to remedy that to mark Hulse's 150th anniversary back in 2024. But now the nature writer Robert McFarlane has added words to the piece called The Silent Planet, where he improvises alongside the folk duo Stevens and Pound.
What do you hear? When the first rains fall, earth awakens. Water braids, shimmers. Droplets and drops weave streams to rivers. Rivers, rivers, life givers, sea makers, silver makers. And rock. Who'd have thought rock could keep time as earth's back beat, bass, drum, rhyme, shuddering core and mantle hum, its roiling iron undersong. And ice.
Robert McFarlane, whose voice you heard there, joins us now. He's the author of The Lost Words and is a River Alive, amongst other work. Morning to you, Robert.
Morning, Nick.
The Silent Planet, it's called because Hulse made it silent.
Yeah, well, two reasons. Hulse left it uncomposed, as it were. I never noticed that. I don't know if you did.
No, until I read into this, I thought, oh, of course, it's not in the suite. Yeah.
Exactly. It strikes with the force of a revelation. He left it out because he was an astrologer. He was a very keen horoscope reader, and he deemed Earth to be astrologically insignificant. So Hulse silenced it, as it were, but it's doubly silent because I suppose we wanted to make a work that responds to the loss of voice on this earth of ours, this beautiful polyphonic earth of ours. And we are losing singers. We're losing the great animal orchestra, where there are 70 million fewer birds in British skies than there were 50 years ago. We've got quieter springs, more silent dawns and dusks. So how to evoke in music and word the glory of polyphony, but also the peril of silence.
This is not just music, then. It has a message.
Yeah, I hope so. And as we know, the environment, quote unquote, can be a hard issue to engage with. It overwhelms us. It's sublime in its dispersals, its immensities, its complexities. And I think art has potentially a hugely powerful role to play in this. Music, I mean, I'm technically musically incompetent, but I spend a great deal of my time working with musicians, writing for music and increasingly performing with them. And music...
That, That performing sounds quite tough, Robert. I mean, are you really improvising?
So, well, the musicians are improvising, and in the concerts that are upcoming, we have the Britain Symphonia Orchestra with us, and there will be, unusually, there will be members of the orchestra improvising to the words and to Delia and Will Stevens and Pound's music as well. So some of it is, it's a back and forth. It's a dance, I suppose, between words and music. As a writer, it's thrilling. You get this free lift off. You become a bird.
Yeah, it must be rather thrilling to be in the audience because, in a sense, you are watching a unique single performance.
Yes. And that's, I mean, that is the nature of live. As we know, all live is live and unique in the moment. This more so than others because of the kind of whir and the blur and the improvisation and spontaneity of it. And the musicians are dazzling. I mean, what they do is indistinguishable from magic to me.
Now, you've performed with them before on a bit of the coast that I know rather well, the Suffolk coastline, Orford Ness.
Yeah.
You work with them.
Yeah, have you been out there to the Untrue Island, as I call it?
Yes, I'm there regularly, actually. Usually upside down in a rather badly sailed boat, actually, Robert. But
yeah, well, as you know, that Orford Ness, now a National Trust site, was a former nuclear weapons testing site and indeed ordnance testing site throughout most of the 20th century. And we, working with the musician Hayden Thorpe, we adapted a long book-length poem of mine called Ness into a performance that took place on Orford Ness, and in the audience at the first performances in 2024 was an unusual audience member in the form of a nuclear weapon, decommissioned, obviously. And that's where I met Delia Stevens, the percussionist at the heart of this new Hulse project.
And has inspired you then to do it on another scale. Well, it sounds very exciting. We can see it at the Barbican when?
Barbican on Wednesday, then Norwich at the Showground on Thursday, and then Cambridge West Road on Friday.
And there'll be a recording of it as well, I assume, Robert?
Yes, so the single Earth, the Silent Planet is out now, and then there'll be a longer album out in due course.
Well, I didn't see the live performance at Orford Ness, but I heard it, thanks in no part to the wonderful Nick Gold, who we'll be remembering this weekend in Orford. Robert McFarlane, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
It is 27 minutes past eight now. Carthy's back with the sport.
Thank you, sport. And a bit of classical music news for Nick, actually. Orford Ness has a piece that I'll send to you by Doreen Carwithen, which is the Suffolk Suite. But tennis news for now on the Australian Open, where temperatures are around 44 degrees. The world number one, Aryna Sabalenka, who is aiming to win a third Australian Open title, defeated the talented American teenager Iva Jovic in straight sets to reach the semi-finals. Last year's finalist, Alexander Zverev, beat the 20-year-old American Lerner Tien earlier as well in four sets. On court right now with the roof on in Melbourne is the two-time Grand Slam champion Coco Gauff. She is 3-1 down though against Elena Svitolina. And the world number one, Carlos Alcaraz, takes on Australia's Alex de Minaur. After that match, 5 Sports Extra for commentary over on Tennis Breakfast. Tierno Barry scored his 4th goal in 5 Premier League games to claim a point for Everton against Leeds, and that 1-1 draw moves Everton up to 10th place. To cricket, and England's men play the decisive 3rd one-day international against Sri Lanka in Colombo. That match starts in around half an hour's time. The former England assistant coach, Paul Farbrace, joins us. Morning, Paul.
Good morning.
Given the Ashes defeat and with the T20 World Cup coming up, a series win against Sri Lanka would be a rather helpful confidence boost for England right now, wouldn't it?
It would be a huge boost, wouldn't it? I mean, actually, to win a game with it, I think that's broken a run of a lot of defeats on the bounce. But it was a good win. I saw Harry Brook describing it as the worst pitch he'd ever played on. Well, unfortunately, you're going to see exactly the same today. A day game in Colombo with the heat means that the ball, with the amount, the heat on the pitch and how it dries under that sunshine, the ball sticks in the pitch and it's a tough pitch to bat on. But that's exactly what they're going to have to get used to for this upcoming T20 World Cup they're going to be playing shortly.
Yeah, well, Brook had a decent knock alongside Ben Duckett and another good innings from Joe Root. And Joe Root has said that his game has improved tenfold under Brendan McCullum. That's a strong endorsement, with some big decisions coming up pretty soon from the ECB.
Yeah, I mean, players will always support their coaches that they're working with, and Root is a very honest, straightforward guy, you know, and it's a great thing for him to come out and say, actually, you know, thinking about it, I would quite like to see Joe Root in the T20 squad going to this World Cup. Sadly, he's not, because he's shown his class over these last two games in Colombo, and he'll have to bat really well again today to show and help England have a chance of winning this game today.
Yeah, the match starting in around half an hour's time. And in that second one-day international game, which they won, which England won, it was the first time that they'd used six different spinners. Does that tell us anything?
Well, as I say, it confirms that, you know, on a, in a day game in Sri Lanka, in a country like Sri Lanka, you will bowl a lot of spin. If it was a day-nighter, it'd be very different because of the dewy conditions, difficult for the spinners to hold it. But in a day game, it wouldn't surprise you. And I would be amazed if it's not a very similar surface today with an awful lot of spin being bowled again. And it'll be the team that plays spin the best that will win this game today.
And with the T20 World Cup coming up, which players particularly are impressing you at the moment that we're looking forward to seeing in the next month?
Well, I think Butler's going to be a huge player in that, as Duckett will be as well. But Butler will have to be England's main man. He's experienced. You know, you'll be looking at people like Salt at the top of the order to play well and get England off to a good start, because it'll be really important on those spinning pitches. You've got to take advantage of the new ball with the field up in the power play. So, you know, the top order are going to be the key people. Rashid with the ball will always be our main man in those conditions. He's a fantastic bowler, getting better with experience. And he and Dawson have been the outstanding bowlers so far in the first two ODIs.
Yeah, well, Paul Farbrace, thank you very much for joining us. But yeah, as you say, a series win would be very helpful. Sri Lanka versus England starts at 9 o'clock, and England's women's cricket captain, Natsiva Brunt, hit the first century in women's Premier League history. She helped the Mumbai Indians earn a 15-run win over Royal Challengers Bengaluru.
Thank you, Cathy. Later today, a new series continues.
There's so much evidence behind fibre.
The data cannot be argued with.
It's one of the most impactful things we can do for our health.
How much do you really know about fibre?
It's ironic, isn't it? Because it is good for you, it is not seen as being a pleasure or a treat.
Join me, Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall, for a new series, Discovering What Fibre Can Do For Us.
Somebody in this family has been undermining my mission.
Buying white pasta behind my back.
The Fibre Factor. Every afternoon this week at 1:45 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
This is real heartwarming comfort food.
What a good way to eat beans.
The weather today has some problems in store, actually. Do watch out. There are some weather warnings around. There'll be heavy rain pushing north and east. Heavy hill snow in the north, along with some gales too in the north and also in the west.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4. It's coming up to 27 minutes to 9 o'clock. Alongside Anna Foster and me, Nick Robinson, here is Caroline Nichols with a summary of the news.
A controversial Border Patrol commander and some immigration agents are expected to start withdrawing from Minneapolis after the city's Democratic mayor held talks with President Trump. Jacob Frey said Mr. Trump agreed that the present situation cannot continue. Commander Gregory Bovino had claimed without evidence that a man shot by officers on Saturday was planning a massacre. Around 50 Labour MPs have written to the Prime Minister urging him to rethink the decision to prevent Andy Burnham standing as an MP. They warned that losing the upcoming by-election in Gorton and Denton to Reform UK would be unimaginable. A Number 10 source says ministers are pursuing a hard-headed, grown-up approach to relations with China as Keir Starmer prepares to travel to Beijing today. It'll be the first visit to the country by a British Prime Minister in 8 years. The government has announced a £250 cap on ground rents paid by leaseholders in England and Wales. Labour's election manifesto promised to tackle unregulated charges affecting some 5 million homes, most of them flats.
Caroline, thank you very much indeed. Now 26 minutes to nine. Today, the anniversary of the liberation of the Auschwitz-Birkenau concentration and death camp run by the Nazis is Holocaust Memorial Day, a day when we commemorate the 6 million Jewish men, women and children murdered during the Holocaust and the millions more murdered under Nazi persecution. Yet the number of schools marking this day is falling. It appears to have more than halved since 2023. More than 2,000 secondary schools across the UK held commemorative or educational events in that year, but the figure for last year had plunged to just 854, according to the data from the Holocaust Memorial Trust. We're joined by two people who do what they can to preserve the memories of the Holocaust, but also the message that we can, that we should learn from what happened in the past. In the studio with me, Dov Foreman, 22-year-old New York Times best-selling author of Lily's Promise, which tells the story of his great-grandmother, Lily Ebert, MBE, who I had the great privilege of knowing. And on the line, Julia Kayes, daughter of Harry Ulmer, MBE, one of the first Holocaust child survivors to move to the UK, one of the first Windermere children. Good morning to you both.
Morning, Nick.
Good morning.
Dov, you show, and after the sad death of your great-grandmother, that it is still possible to connect people of your age and younger with the message of this day. You do it incredibly successfully on TikTok, what, with more than 2 billion views. What is it that you do to engage people?
Well, today is an incredibly important day, and the first thing I'll say is how sad I am not to be sat alongside my great-grandmother, and how sad I am not to be joined by Harry Ulmer, who passed away only a few weeks ago, and my condolences to Julia and her family. He was a great man and a great inspiration of mine, and I went to Poland with him in 2023. My great-grandmother's story touched the hearts and minds of so many millions of people while she was alive. Her going out, sharing that story, the harrowing things that she saw in the hell of Auschwitz-Birkenau, where her mother, her younger sister, her youngest brother were murdered. But I think that today the theme of Holocaust Memorial Day is bridging the generations. And it's more important than ever, as you say, when the number of schools marking this has seemingly gone down, when clearly in the consciousness of the human mind, what led to the Holocaust, that anti-Semitism is being forgotten because we're seeing that anti-Semitism resurgent in society again. I think it's important that we preserve those stories. So I do that through social media. I ensure that whilst hate on social media is so rife and where it can spread so easily, we have those true survivor stories, even whilst they're passed away, those videos, I'm posting them every single day to ensure that people can remember my great-grandmother, not only for the incredible woman that she was, but for the incredibly important messages that she shared about hate, about where that hate, if left unchecked and unchallenged, can lead to. And that's to places like Auschwitz-Birkenau, that's to a person like my great-grandmother being reduced to a number, A10572. That was the number that she was given in Auschwitz-Birkenau, a permanent reminder of the Nazis' crimes against humanity. And those are things which I try to share every day on social media, along with the light, the fact that you can rebuild, that you can get through any darkness in life, and that you can smile and that you can build a family. My great-grandmother had 10 grandchildren, 38 great-grandchildren, of which I'm a proud member, and one great-great-grandchild in her final year.
Julia, your father, and commiserations on your
Thank
loss.
You.
Your father,
Thank you
Harry...
so much.
Inspired so many with the talks that he gave about what he'd been through and the extraordinary welcome that he got here in the UK.
My father sadly passed away quite suddenly, actually, only 12 days ago. And he was educating pretty much until the end of his life. He absolutely would not refuse to go to any event, to any school, to any organisation to speak and tell about his horrors and what he went through. But really his story is a story of survival in the truest sense of the word. He never wanted to be defined by what happened to him in his early years and the trauma that he went through and the murder of all his family, pretty much every member of his family. He was always an incredibly positive person who wanted to look forward and build a life and build a future for the family that he created.
Julia, Harry didn't want this, though, to be just about remembering him and his generation, did he? He wanted, as Dov just said, this to be a message across the ages.
Yes, he was very keen that the legacy that he began and that we now have to take over the mantle of is continued. He was a particular advocate of going to schools and educating anywhere and everywhere in the country. And he had been very involved over the last 9 years with a project called Echo Eternal, which got children from all over the country, many of whom had never even met or seen a Jewish person before, to engage in the Holocaust through the medium of dance and music.
Let me bring Dov again, and I'll come back to you, Julia, if I may.
Of course.
The challenge is clearly the contemporary context. It is clear that there are schools cancelling this memorial because they fear exacerbating the phrase that's often used, community tensions. Speak, Dov, directly to people who might say, well, that was then. We don't need to do it now. Or if we do, we need to talk about Gaza. We need to talk to somewhere else. What is the universal message that you want to be heard on this Holocaust Memorial Day?
Well, I think that's completely wrong. The Holocaust is unique in human history, and the scale, the systematic nature of it. Auschwitz-Birkenau, where over 1.1 million people were murdered. My great-grandmother, a Hungarian survivor, over 500,000 murdered in the period of 6 weeks. Something like that had never been seen before in history, but not just that. The Holocaust, of course, is important today, and we can see that just by the statistics of anti-Semitism over the past 3 years. I'm sat here as a British Jew in 2026 on Holocaust Memorial Day, and how shocking is it to say that I don't know one single friend of mine who's 22 years old. In fact, I don't know one single British Jew who hasn't considered their future in this country, not because they fear that they might be slaughtered on the streets, because they fear what this country might be for their grandchildren, for their great-grandchildren. And they see this anti-Semitism, this anti-Jewish hatred, which didn't start in 1933 and end in 1945 with the Holocaust and with the whim of one dictator. It's been throughout history, and it mutates, and it's a virus, and that virus is infecting society again. And the fact that people are worried about community tensions, I think that speaks to a whole another part of the social fabric of this country, but it clearly shows that there are people who think that the Holocaust is some sort of thing that can be played with, and that's even something which we can just discard, as if the Holocaust couldn't happen again. Of course, there won't be gas chambers again, but violent anti-Semitism is returning. We've seen that in Bondi, with Manchester, and these are the direct calls of words which are again prevalent in society.
Julia, it has to be one sentence, I'm afraid, because we have other stories to cover, but in a sentence, give us your message on this Holocaust Memorial Day.
Education has to continue so that we can stop any kind of hate and any kind of prejudice happening on a large scale. Unfortunately, the world is not looking very positive at the moment, and we need to do everything we can to keep these stories alive, to get people to understand that the spread of anti-Semitism will not end with anti-Semitism.
Julia.
It will end with many types of prejudice that we need to be concerned about.
Julie Case, thank you so much for coming so soon after the death of your father, Harry Ulmer, one of the first Holocaust child survivors to move here to the UK, and Dov Foreman with your powerful memories of Lily Ebert, MBE.
It is 18 minutes to nine now. The BBC is launching its biggest music education initiative in a decade this morning, and it's about trying to encourage teenagers to sing together. It's called BBC Get Singing. It'll be free on BBC Bite Size. It's been launched because of a fall in communal singing among children when they reach secondary school age, which tends to happen when they're embarrassed about themselves and everything around them. So this wants to try and change that. Our education reporter, Kate McGough, has more.
When the little green frog one day, when the little green frog...
Singing together as a choir is something that happens less often as students reach their teenage years. A recent survey of teachers in England by the survey tool TeacherTap found that a third of state secondary schools don't have a choir, and there's significantly less communal singing that happens in daily school life at secondary school than at primary. To tackle this, the BBC has launched a nationwide music education initiative called BBC Get Singing.
Can you give me a woof, woof, woof?
The aim is to get 11 to 14-year-olds across the UK singing together, both in and out of school. From today, BBC Bite Size will have free access to arrangements of two songs that teenagers can try, including one by the Traitors star and singer Kat Burns, with more to come throughout the year. There's also advice on vocal warm-ups, backing tracks, and a range of resources to help teachers and students explore each song. These students at Parswood High School in Manchester were among the first to try the new arrangements.
I think that it brings everyone together because obviously everyone's on their phones and like focusing on what they want to see.
I'm Cameron. I enjoy doing music, like inside of school and outside of school, so it just makes me happy.
I'm Neve. I'm 12 years old. I've made so many friends because of it, and I'm just so grateful to have choir at school.
What do you think you would be doing if there was no choir?
I'd be probably be home and being watching TV shows, which I would not want to do. I'd rather be here.
And when we sing, we go, the idea is you're singing from your diaphragm.
Seven-time Grammy Award-winning musician Jacob Collier is an ambassador for the scheme. He says the act of singing together can overcome feelings of social and digital isolation that many teenagers experience.
Those of us who had the experience, I think, as children of singing in choirs never forget the feeling, because you're part of something much bigger than yourself. It bypasses so many of the sort of
artificial digital boundaries that are sort of created around us and remind us of something far more ancient than that. You know, music embeds a sense of confidence, I think, in the individual in a way that nothing else does. And that can be applied to anything that you go on in your life and do.
There are also plans to commission a research project through BBC Get Singing that will explore the benefits of collective singing.
How much it helps develop young people's brains.
Back in Manchester, music teacher Becky Gosher says the mental health benefits of singing are clear.
It just gives them that lift, that take away from everything else that's going on. You can park everything else at the door and just be you, just have fun, just smile.
How hard is it to persuade teenagers to sing?
Getting them to see that music isn't just something that happens on a phone sometimes is quite difficult. But it is so important that they get up and get involved in the industry, in performing, in what music is meant to be. It's not meant to be something that happens sat in rows behind a desk with a textbook in front of you.
It's hoped that targeting 11 to 14-year-olds will not just reverse a decline in singing at secondary school, but bring skills and resilience that will last a lifetime.
It's Kate McGough reporting there.
It is now 14 minutes to nine. Now, one of the most dramatic pieces of railway track in the country, as you'll know if you've been on it, is Dawlish, which goes, well, it feels when you're on the train as if you're almost in the sea, but it is certainly right next to the sea. And those of you with good memories will remember that it pretty much fell into the sea back in 2014. Well, it's been taking a battering due to the weather we've been hearing about from Helen. We just want to get the latest from our reporter, Johnny Rutherford, who is in Dawlish in Devon. What can you tell us, Johnny?
Yes, indeed. Well, it's still getting a battering this morning. I'm standing right next to where there is a gap in the wall that protects the train line that was hit by Ingrid just last weekend there. And the waves are already bashing over the top. My goodness, that was a very large one. It's just covering us, you might be able to hear it, at the moment. And of course, it's not till 12 o'clock before it's high tide. Last night, the residents here, where houses were covered yet again with large waves going over the house and heavy, heavy rain, which of course has gone completely across the southwest here. Very, very wet travelling here this morning for my lives into breakfast and on radio. Roads were blocked, flooded. It's closed on the A30 near Exeter Airport, and there are several flood warnings for Devon. And many rivers, of course, are just completely bursting their banks. It's quite intense.
Well, we can hear the waves behind you, Johnny. Thank you very much indeed. What's the wider travel picture? The Five Live travel presenter, Orna Merchant, joins us now, and she can tell us. Morning, Orna.
Good morning to you, Nick. Yeah, it's lots of road closures in. It's where all the warnings are. We've had the amber rain warning, which runs out at about 9 o'clock, but it's for Northern Ireland. So we've actually had routes called in from Northern Ireland this morning. But one of the main problems we've had has been the M5, which we don't talk about first thing in the morning because it's always free flowing. But because of floodwater, two lanes have been closed on the M5 this morning, so that's caused some major problems for traffic at Taunton. So at Junction 25, you still have the two lanes closed. Only one lane's open. The queues are back to Junction 24 at Bridgewater South. And so many A roads in Devon, Dorset and Somerset have been closed. Many major routes as well. It's unusual, but all to do with these warnings that we've had for Storm Chandra. The A30 in East Devon's closed, and that's near Ottery St Mary. Also the A303, that's Somerset-Devon border, that's closed in both directions between the A30 at Ottery and the A358 at Horton Cross. The A35 in Dorset is also closed near the A352 and the bridges as well. So the M48 original seven bridges closed in both directions if you're travelling between Wales and England this morning. The M4 Prince of Wales Bridge is running well. That's the good news. We've had snow on higher ground. More of that is expected as well. The A66 between Brough and Bowes is closed to all traffic in both directions. That's the very latest.
Orna Merchant, thank you very much indeed. Remember, BBC Local Radio, BBC Online will give you the detail for your area.
It's 11 minutes to nine. The polar explorer Max Worsley is preparing to take on what will be a remarkable feat, skiing unsupported for more than 1,300 kilometres across Antarctica. But it's also a deeply personal journey. It will be tracing the footsteps of Max's dad, Henry, who also dreamed of crossing the continent, inspired by his hero, Ernest Shackleton. Now, Henry sadly died during his attempt in 2016, and that is one of the reasons that Max wants to do it now. And he joins us. Max, good morning.
Hi, Anna. Good morning.
It's really good to talk to you. And I really want to talk about some of the detail of how you'll do it, which I find extraordinary. But I'd like to first of all, really talk about your dad and your whole reason for doing this. And he was so inspired and so driven by people like Ernest Shackleton. This was your childhood, watching him pursue this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Ernest Shackleton was dad's hero, his mentor. And it's sort of been a quiet constant in our household for as long as I can remember, really, with, you know, photos of explorers on the wall and maps on the kitchen table. So it was sort of set in me from quite a young age to do an expedition like this. And, you know, the dream was to do it with dad, and in some ways we will still be, but it's more than that now. There's a, you know, big impact on people and planet that we want to make with this expedition as well.
Yeah, and so much of it will be along the exact route that he took. You're going to stop and camp in the same places?
Exactly, yeah. We'll be doing exactly the same route from to the pole, and we'll get picked up from the pole, whereas dad was doing a crossing. And I'll be reading from his diary in the same places that he was writing it, which will be quite special.
Yeah, it will. I think your mum is an extraordinary woman because she has given you her blessing to do this. And I can't imagine as a mum saying to a child, well, you're not a child, of course you're not, but, you know, to for her to have lost your dad in that way and to support you like this, I think is amazing.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, my mum's been absolutely incredible with it, and my sister, Alicia. I think it's going to be difficult moments, but fortunately, you know, this isn't sort of an impulse decision after dad dying. It's something that I've wanted to do for a long time, and mum knows that. But I don't think that makes it much easier. So, it means a lot that she's giving me her support.
Yeah, and the training and the planning, it's all started already. You'll set off in November. So what will be the most challenging elements?
Yeah, I'll set off in November with Martin, my expedition partner. And I think the most challenging elements, we've got a big climb up through the Pensacola Mountains, where we go over sort of 1,000 metres of vertical gain, pulling 130 kilograms in a sled behind us, all of our food and our fuel and everything. There's a few crevasses in that region, so we'll need to be, you know, fully focused to make sure that we're, you know, avoiding those and navigating the glaciers properly.
How do you train for something like that? Because it's not like you can, well, it's hard to find comparable conditions.
It is, yeah. I mean, the closest to sort of in Norway, Greenland, you go crevasse rescue training in places like Chamonix, and just spend as much time as possible camping in very cold conditions in the middle of sort of plateaus in Norway, etc. So Martin and I have done a bunch of that last year and this year, and we've together been training for, you know, 4 or 5 years for this expedition. So yeah, a lot goes into it.
It does. Well, look, good luck with the training as it goes on, Max, and let's keep in touch because we'd love to hear how you get on with it. Thanks so much for telling us about it.
Just a word about what's coming up here on Radio 4 at 9 o'clock, already on BBC Sounds. Ransom Man. Sounds like a fascinating story about the theft of the therapy notes of every patient of a psychotherapy service in Finland. Jelly Kleeman tells the story. Here's the victim's stories, and you can hear them on Ransom Man. Well, just before we go, though, a word about a new piece of music. Well, not that new, but it is newly very, very popular. A Cornish electronic music artist has actually overtaken Taylor Swift in the monthly YouTube music listeners. You may well not have heard, I certainly hadn't, of Aphex Twin, but if you scroll through social media, TikTok, Instagram, look at YouTube videos, you may well hear this track, as it's frequently used as backing music to social media videos. That is QK Third by Aphex Twin. And here to tell us why it's so successful is Sophia Smith-Gaylor, digital journalist, founder of the social media agency Viralect, and Will Hodgkinson, author and chief rock and pop critic for The Times. Sophia, what's happened? How has that sound become the sound of 26?
Well, Nick, how did you feel when you were listening to it? It had that harmonium in the background. Yeah. It's sort of expansive, dreamy quality, almost. It has a sense of the uncanny about it. It invites introspection, and that's exactly what you want. That's the perfect recipe for an audio bed set to go viral on a platform like TikTok and Instagram, where users are putting that music as a backing track for videos about memory, nostalgia. That's why it's done so well.
Yeah, and Will, it's done so well partly because of the technology that we often decry, partly because of the algorithm, presumably.
Yes, the algorithm can pick up on anything. I mean, essentially what's happened is that now the history of recorded music is available to everyone, anywhere, at all times. And somehow, the Aphex Twin, who's a big name in the 90s, but has been very quiet since, has become the listening choice of Gen Z. So I'm personally very pleased about it, because I think this is amazing music.
Yeah. And do you agree with Sophia that it is partly because it was kind of therapeutic?
Well, I also think that a lot of, if you listen to Aphex Twin's music, it's even the most beautiful music has something jarring and disturbing about it. I mean, one of his most famous pieces is called Avril the 14th, and it sounds like a lovely piano composition. But if you listen carefully, there's something not quite human about it, and that's because it wasn't actually done on a piano. It's done on a disc clavier, which is a piano that reads electronic data. So there's always this kind of a slightly dystopian element to the Aphex Twin's music, which I think speaks to our age just as much as it did back in the 90s.
And Sophia, am I right that the algorithm, in a way, enables people just to keep coming across something they may not have known, may never have heard of, and go, yeah, no, I like that, and on it goes?
Absolutely, and it reaches this kind of saturation point where you'll have heard it so many times, you'll have seen it on your feed so many times, that it gives you a certain kind of feeling, because it'll always be associated not only sonically, just as Will described there, but in the video edits used with the music. You instantly feel hopeful, sad, melancholic, nostalgic, and it's really easy from a user design perspective to press a couple of buttons and you've already made your own video with the same track.
And Sophia, we often talk on the programme about whether musicians are actually benefiting in any way from these huge numbers of plays that they get, and how little they get from platforms like Spotify. Is Aphex doing well as a result of this? Aphex Twin.
I'm aware he has released some new music. Any good team behind an artist would be supporting them in using a viral moment like this, which has now lasted years. I mean, this track has been popular for a long time now, even though it came out in 2001. But it's been really popular for a long time on short form platforms now. And it will definitely offer benefit, but you're right to acknowledge that it's probably not as much as it should be.
Will, do you see him managing to get a new career or a new boost to his career as a result?
I think he's doing fine anyway. I mean, I don't think he ever wanted... He was quite a reluctant star. You know, he came out of the Cornish sort of free party scene of the 90s, then made this music which combines all aspects of electronic music, minimalism, you know, Eric Satie style. You know, he's a very, very creative individual. And he's had a lot of success already. So I think he's doing absolutely fine. This just means that the music gets to a new audience.
Well, if he's in Cornwall, he's probably hiding from Storm Chandra at the moment. Maybe composing.
He probably is.
Something new. And just briefly, you two would recommend it to people listening, would you?
Oh, well, I would. I think he's the Mozart of electronic music. I think it's what he did was so revolutionary in, you know, kind of going beyond genre, but also having this kind of very rebellious spirit. If you listen to a lot of this music, even, like I said, even the prettiest music, there's something disturbing going on, and I think that's got depth.
Will's already given a phrase for his latest marketing campaign. Sophia, you've got 10 seconds to see if you can match it.
Disturbing music for a disturbing world. If you want to check out a video that 21 million views for his selected ambient works on YouTube, go listen to it now.
Aphex Twin, we're talking about, and you were just hearing Sophia Smith-Gaylor and Will Hodgkin.